Good Tuesday to you. Welcome to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty coming up in a little bit, talking about the primary elections held across the country. Also, in a few minutes here, Tony and Monica Seabers will be with us. They are the owners of the Sea Bears. Get it? Seabers. Sea Bears. The Sea Bears Ogden Fish House in Ogden, Utah. Saw a story about the Seabers. It's a family-run business, a family-run restaurant. The kids are working there as well. And the interesting thing about this restaurant is, you know, we've talked with restaurateurs from around the country before who welcome gun owners. Many of them offer discounts for concealed carry holders. Well, there at Sea Bears, the servers are carrying, open carrying, for customer and their own safety. So we'll talk with the Seabers coming up in just a little bit. They say, by the way, business is good there at Sea Bears. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League with the latest on the attempt in Lexington, Massachusetts. Yes, that Lexington, you know, Lexington and Concord. The British are coming, that Lexington, to ban commonly owned semi-automatic firearms. This is going apparently before the town meeting on April the 6th. Although it looks like there are attempts there in Lexington, Massachusetts, to pull back from this proposed bylaw. We'll talk with Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum with a Nanny State update. We're going to be taking Julie and some of her colleagues from the Independent Women's Forum to the NRA range later in the week. We'll discuss that as well. Dan Bongino writing a conservative review on the ICE officials who let it be known that 124 illegal immigrants who were released from jail, later charged in 138 different homicide cases. And we'll talk again with Dan about that in Hour 3. Also coming up in Hour 3, Catherine Mortensen, NRA-ILA media liaison. In Nevada, you know, Bloomberg and his groups are out there pushing a quote-unquote universal background check referendum on the ballot this year, and they are enlisting churches around the state of Nevada to help push this gun control initiative. So we'll talk with Catherine Mortensen about that in Hour 3. We also have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, our Deal of the Day, and our Good Guy coming up at the top of Hour 3 as well. Plus, we are also paying attention to the latest legislative news from around the country. We told you about campus carry in Georgia, the campus safety bill getting to Governor Nathan Deal's desk. Governor Deal indicating that he wants to see some changes, perhaps, to the legislation. Now, there are only, I think, 4 days left in the legislative session in Georgia. Saw that earlier today, NRA's Institute for Legislative Action had tweeted out information on contacting Governor Deal there in Georgia and urging him to sign House Bill 859. So if you are a gun owner in Georgia, want to make sure that the governor has heard from you. Also in Idaho, permitless carry is headed to the floor of the Idaho Senate. You know, we've already seen West Virginia's legislature approve permitless carry this year. The West Virginia governor, Earl Ray Tomlin, vetoing the legislation, but lawmakers there in Charleston, West Virginia, overriding the governor's veto. Now in Idaho, where you already have enhanced concealed carry licenses. Right now, in fact, you have open carry without a permit. This bill would let people carry concealed without a permit. People ages 18 through 20 would still need to get their concealed carry license, like what we've seen in the state of West Virginia. And the concealed carry license would not go away in the state of Idaho either, for people, you know, who want to leave the state of Idaho and exercise their right to carry in other states where they have reciprocity. You'd still want your concealed carry license, but permitless carry, again, would be the law of the land. Now, the law would not take effect until 90 days after the legislature adjourns for the session. The Senate State Affairs Committee approving the bill on a 6-3 vote, no debate or discussion, according to the Herald Dispatch newspaper. They're in the state of Idaho. Hannah Sharp with Moms Demand Action there in Idaho. said, if signed into law, SB 1389 would dismantle our current system and put Idahoans at risk, including law enforcement officers who risk their safety to protect us. So why, she asked, are our elected leaders attempting to undo a system that has worked for a century and is supported by law enforcement? Now, you know, it's interesting. We could look at what's happened in other states that have passed permitless carry. Vermont, you know, for instance, has had permitless carry for quite some time. Arizona passed their permitless carry bill back in 2009, I believe it was. And I was just looking at Arizona's crime stats yesterday. It has not been, as people predicted, a return to the wild, wild west. Right, we've heard that a lot. It has not been Thunderdome. Snake Plissken is not running for governor there in the state of Arizona. Instead, violent crime has continued to drop. 2009 is 426.5 violent crimes per 100,000 people. In 2014, it was down to 399.9 violent crimes per 100,000 people. 5.8 homicides per 100,000 people in 2009, 4.7 in 2014. Robberies have declined from 124 down to 93. Aggravated assaults have dipped from 262 to 252. Burglaries are down from 823 to 647. Again, crime has dropped in the state of Arizona. And by the way, the number of concealed carry holders in the state of Arizona actually increased after permitless carry was introduced. So we have seen the same arguments that have been made ever since concealed carry laws went into effect around the country in many states, you know, 30-plus years ago. The same general argument made against permitless carry, but what's actually happened is far different from the scary scenarios presented by anti-gun advocates. The Herald-Dispatch says, if the measure is approved, which is likely in the Republican-dominated state house in the middle of an election year, Idaho would join a short list of states with no such requirements. This includes Alaska, Arizona, Kansas, Maine, Vermont, Wyoming, and West Virginia. Arkansas, the Herald-Dispatch says, has a similar law, but the current and previous attorneys general have disagreed on the interpretation, and a handful of similar proposals are also making their way through other state legislatures this year. Yes. And again, it should be noted what is happening around the country. You are not seeing, nor have you seen, in any state that has adopted laws regarding the carrying of firearms. Not one state has moved to rescind those laws. Have you noticed that? We've not seen a single state around the country that once it is implemented a concealed carry law, moved to do away with it. Oh, this was horrible for the state. We got to scrap this law. Not one. We still have a handful of states that are discretionary issue, where you can meet all the statutory requirements to get your carry license, and you can be denied for no reason whatsoever. But again, we also have a growing number of states that are taking the opposite step. They're saying, listen, it's your right to keep and to bear arms. And as long as you are a legal gun owner, a law-abiding citizen of the state, then no permit is required. As a matter of fact, you know, I would say that the momentum in this country right now is certainly on the side, again, of legal, lawful carrying of firearms, and it would be getting rid of the right of Americans to bear arms for defense of themselves and others. Despite the efforts by groups like Everytown and Moms Demand Action, trying to oppose piecemeal any attempt to legally carry a firearm, again, legislatively, what we've seen are moves to secure that right to keep and bear arms. And again, it looks like Idaho may be the latest state to do so. They were also talking campus carry in the state of Missouri yesterday. And I'm sure at some point we will hear the arguments that we have heard in Texas and in Georgia. The college students there in Columbia and elsewhere, too immature, too irresponsible, too inebriated to carry a firearm. They may even bring up the protests there on the campus at the University of Missouri last year. Look, we've already got a campus on edge. Can you imagine what would happen if we allowed for these students to carry firearms? But here's the thing. The law, the proposed law in Missouri, would apply to public colleges and universities, include exceptions for areas on campus with grade school children, some sporting events, some hospitals. Universities could apply for an exemption if the building were staffed with armed security, metal detectors, were made hard targets, in other words, then that campus could be exempt. If not, then those concealed carry holders would be allowed to carry on campus. The same folks, again, who are already carrying off campus, who aren't committing crimes, aren't behaving irresponsibly, may or may not be engaged in protests or support of any variety of subjects, who knows, but they're behaving lawfully and legally. And again, we already know that on the campus of the University of Missouri, we have attempts to chill speech right now, right? Without campus carry coming into the equation at all, there are attempts by students, attempts by professors to chill the First Amendment rights of others, to seek out muscle against student reporters who might be covering protests. So if they try to make this an issue, and again, I'm sure that they will, what they're really pointing out, again, is the immaturity, the irresponsibility of their own supporters. But they're not speaking to the folks who actually are concealed carry holders there in the state of Missouri. And frankly, I'm curious to see what the reaction is from students and from parents around the state as well. We've already seen a 25% drop, apparently, in enrollment in the freshman class, incoming freshman class at the University of Missouri. This was perhaps not unexpected, but it was a little unanticipated by the university administrators. So if parents start to feel like maybe the campus is getting back to some sense of sanity, maybe those numbers will start to go up. But we're keeping our eyes on that story out of the Show Me State of Missouri. We've also got more legislative news to tell you about throughout the afternoon, including more news out of Massachusetts. We're going to talk with Jim Wallace about what's going on in Lexington, Massachusetts. But around the state, there are more and more gun owners who are getting their license to carry. You know, in Massachusetts, they're phasing out. They've got a weird, convoluted licensing system, in part because the state of Massachusetts really doesn't think that you have an individual right to keep and bear arms. But they've had their Class A, Class B. I think they might have even had a Class C license there in Massachusetts. They're trying to phase out those other licenses. The Class A license is your license to own, your license to carry. And Massachusetts, just like every other state in the union right now, seeing more people become gun owners and more people actually take the step to exercise their right to carry from coast to coast. We are seeing this happen. That is, again, the response that we have seen for months now as Americans embrace or at least acknowledge their right to self-defense, their right to keep and bear arms. So we'll talk about that with Jim Wallace as well coming up next hour. When we return after a quick timeout, here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, we're going to head out to Ogden, Utah, and talk with the owners of Sea Bears Ogden Fish House, Tony and Monica Siebers, who have opened up the family-run restaurant, and they are open carrying for their safety and the safety of their customers. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums, the National Firearms Museum, what's it all about?
Well, you know, we got three museums now. We used to be the museum. Now we're three museums, and this is the home museum, the NRA National Firearms Museum. This is our 80th year of existence, and we are here at the NRA headquarters building. We've got about 3,000 firearms on display, and we have a number of spectacular new exhibits that have just popped up this past year. Usually it's exciting to get maybe one exhibit every other year, but this year we've got a great steampunks guns exhibit that shows fanciful guns that are artists' creations from steampunk fantasy. And then we compare those to actual guns from the Victorian era that kind of have the same sensibility about them and see if you can tell what's real and what's fake. We've also put in exhibits on America's pistol. And I'm very excited about this one. We have been able to reunite for the first time in a century the two actual pistols that did the head-to-head shootout in 1911 for the U.S. Army to pick their issue sidearm, the Savage Model 1911 45 ACP and the Colt Model 1911, both in 45 ACP, and of course the Colt won that head-to-head challenge. But these were the actual guns that were used in those trials, along with a number of other guns that were experimental models leading up to that.
All right, before we run out of time, how do folks get more information about the NRA National Firearms Museum?
Well, they can come visit us at the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. If they can't get by, they can come visit us on the website nramuseums.com.
All right, Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums. That's the NRA National Firearms Museum here in Fairfax. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Here's the truth about the Hollywood celebrities, political elites, and billionaires who attack the Second Amendment. The thought of average people owning firearms makes them uncomfortable. They don't like how the men and women who build their office buildings, vacation homes, and luxury cars, who mop their floors, clean their clothes, and serve their dinner, have access to the same level of protection as their armed security guards. They want you to surrender your freedom for a false promise of government-provided security they will never rely upon themselves. But no amount of money, power, or fame gives anyone the right to take our freedom away. At the core of the Second Amendment is the eternal truth that no life is more worthy of armed protection than another. That's what I believe, and that's what I fight for. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuela's made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty going to join us in a little bit, talking about another Super Tuesday, Super Tuesday 2, Electric Boogaloo. Is that what we're calling this one? Five states up on the Republican side. I think you've got three for the Democrats. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners actually coming up as well. And join us here in just a couple of minutes. We're going to be speaking with Tony and Monica Siebers, the owners of Sea Bears Ogden Fish House in Ogden, Utah, getting some local media coverage there not long ago. Mark Saul with the Standard Examiner
writing a story about the restaurant, says it is either the safest restaurant in town or the most dangerous. Right. It all depends, he says, on how you view the Second Amendment. Well, based on the story there, it appears that a lot of folks in Ogden, Utah, view the right to keep and bear arms as a good thing, because it sounds like business has been good for Sea Bears. The paper says the restaurant becoming known for three things: the food, the servers clad in Scottish kilts, and the sidearms that those servers openly carry while they work. So, again, we'll talk with Tony and Monica Siebers coming up here in just a couple of minutes. You know, unfortunately, it is not unusual to see stories of restaurant robberies, right? I mean, this happens on a fairly regular basis around the country. And we have seen restaurants, you know, in other parts of the country that, as I said, have welcomed gun owners as customers. Here in the state of Virginia, we've got some restaurants that do that. In fact, it's really not unusual to find establishments like that where you come in, you're a concealed carry holder, or you are legally and openly carrying your firearm, you get a discount. We've seen those restaurant owners welcome gun owners as customers, and that's generally worked out well for both the customers and the restaurants themselves. And oddly enough, you know, I haven't seen any stories about those restaurants getting robbed. But we do know where there is a lot of cash, where there is a expectation that perhaps you will have unarmed victims and the possibility for a quick getaway, yeah, you are going to be a target for some criminals. Matter of fact, WOAI in San Antonio talking about another seafood restaurant that just got robbed there. It was at the Fred's Fish Fry last Sunday. Guy armed with a gun walks into the restaurant, demands money from the employee, takes off in a car a couple of minutes later. And again, those stories are repeated around the country on a regular basis, which is why one of the reasons why we have more and more Americans of all walks of life deciding that, you know what, they want to take their safety and their security seriously. So we'll talk with the Siebers coming up here in just a matter of minutes. Also in the state of Kansas, and we're talking yesterday about the anti-gun referendum that's going to be on the ballot in California, likely to be on the ballot, I should say, in California later this year, being pushed by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. In Kansas, they are hoping for a statewide ballot initiative this fall to amend the state constitution to guarantee the right to hunt and fish. Number of states around the country have adopted into the state constitution the right to hunt and fish over the last few years. Kansas could be the last one, or the, next one. There is a bill right now in the Kansas legislature. It is HCR 5008. And Travis Couture Lovelady, who's the Kansas legislative liaison for the NRA, former state representative there in the state of Kansas, has a piece at Kansas.com talking about the efforts to put this on the ballot for Kansans this year. He says Kansas has nearly 1.2 million people in the state hunting, fishing, watching wildlife in a given year, spending almost $1 billion in the state of Kansas on their trips, on their equipment. Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism selling almost $25 million worth of licenses and permits last year. And that money gets turned around and put into conservation programs there in the state of Kansas. That's in addition to the Pittman-Robertson funds that come into the state through the federal excise tax that hunters and sportsmen and gun owners are paying. And yet, despite the economic benefit, despite the benefit to the wildlife in the state of Kansas, there is that threat that exists in the state as well as across the country by anti-hunting activists who would like to make hunting as difficult as possible for the hunters and sportsmen out there. As Travis Couture Lovelady pointed out, dove hunting, banned in Michigan a decade ago, back in 1990, a ballot initiative in California resulted in a ban on mountain hunting lion, or mountain lion hunting. Now, of course, we saw the mountain lion that apparently was responsible for the death of a koala there in California. 19 states now have measures to protect the right to hunt and fish. And Kansas could again be the next one. So HCR 5008 is the legislation there in Kansas. All right, I have just been informed that the Seabers, unfortunately, are not going to be able to join us this afternoon. Maybe there's a lunch rush there at Seabears Ogden Fish House, but we'll try to reconnect. I'm sorry? The line is out the door. So there you go. There was a lunch rush. Maybe we can, we'll get back with them after the lunch rush, and we'll see if we can maybe talk to them. Might have to pre-tape an interview one morning there in Ogden, Utah, with Tony and Monica. But that is, listen, that's good to know, because what did Mark Saul of the Standard Examiner say? It's either the safest restaurant in town or it's the most dangerous. It all depends on how you feel about the Second Amendment. Well, again, given that there's a line out the door this afternoon, I'd say that shows how Ogden feels about the Second Amendment. So let me tell you a little bit about the Seabers, who unfortunately cannot join us this segment. They started the restaurant, I guess it was a couple of years ago. The idea actually was that it was going to be sort of a fast casual place. And then they realized, yeah, it might not actually work out too well because there's problems with parking. It's not the easiest place to park, apparently. So they switched over to a full-service restaurant. Tony said that's where we started finding success. Monica says 98% of the menu, her own recipes, made from scratch, serving up fish and chips, shepherd's pie, hamburgers. They're hitting that milestone that I think any small family business is hoping to reach, that moment where they can start hiring outside of the family. Because that's when you know, like, okay, we've got our sea legs under us there at Seabears. We feel like we're in a good place. Now we can start taking on the responsibility of employing people who aren't related to us as well. And they are doing that. Monica says, you know, working 12 to 15-hour days after a year and a half, she says it gets old. And it does, but you know, when you're starting that business from scratch, you got to put in those hours. And it sounds like the family is doing just that. Jason Holbrook of Ogden talked with Mark Sal of the Standard Examiner, said he comes to the restaurant two or three times a week. Quote, he has no problem with the fact that his servers are often armed. And one would think one wouldn't go if one did have a problem. He said, yeah, Utah has a right to bear arms, right to defend state. Good for them. But he also said it's not because of that that he goes to Seabears. He says it's excellent food. So there you go. You go for the taste, but no one's scared away by the servers there, including the couple's children, who are, again, legally and lawfully, openly carrying a firearm. Monica Siebert says, people tell us it's just one more reason to like it here. They say, we love the food, we love the kilts, and we love the open carry. That's pretty cool. And Monica says they started with nothing. Again, like a lot of small businesses out there. She said, when they first started, the fish that they sold paid for them buying the fish that they would sell the next day, right? So the money we made selling fish one day, we bought fish for the next day. That was it. There really was no savings. There wasn't, we can dip into our reserve fund. But they made it work. She said, we're entrepreneurs first. We're restaurateurs second. She said, we've tried to learn what people want. And so now Tony and Monica, their sons Colin and Chase, all carrying. Their 19-year-old Austin doesn't carry, nor does their 14-year-old daughter, Tolly, who is also working there at the restaurant when needed. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk with the Sabres. They sound like a very nice family. I'm always excited when we can talk with anybody who has managed to take a business from nothing and turn it into an actual honest-to-goodness living, particularly in this economy. No matter what field or industry you're doing it in, that's a heck of an achievement. So, again, hopefully we'll be able to catch up with Tony and Monica Siebers before the Lunch Crush there in Ogden here before long. Now, Andrew Langer of the Institute for Liberty got to join us on the program talking about Super Tuesday 2, right? The revenge of Super Tuesday. Not as many states up for grabs as we had a couple of weeks ago in the original Super Tuesday, but these states are winner-take-all states. So you've got Florida, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, all voting tonight. For the Democrats, Hillary Clinton expected to walk away with Florida. But the open questions are, how will Hillary Clinton do in states like Illinois, where apparently in Chicago her ties to Rahm Emanuel have really dragged her down. Bernie Sanders attacking Rahm Emanuel, saying that it's time for Rahm Emanuel to step down. Hillary Clinton can't really say that because of her relationship with Rahm Emanuel. So, you know, Rahm's a fairly unpopular guy there in the state of Illinois. Never been particularly popular downstate, and he is increasingly unpopular in Chicagoland as well. So there are, again, a number of open questions. The polling over on the Democratic side has typically shown Hillary Clinton with fairly substantial leads in the races today, but the more recent polling has Bernie Sanders pulling within single digits in a lot of these states. And remember, he was down in the polls 20 points in Michigan, ended up winning Michigan, which has a lot of people, again, scratching their heads. How much should we trust the polls this cycle? I would say not much, but I'm sure we will anyway. We'll pay more attention to the polls probably than they deserve. That is the only guideline that we have. And even if it's not a great guideline, it's hard for people to scrap that yardstick when they are used to it. But it is a very open question. Hillary Clinton could sweep all of the primary states today over on the Democratic side. She could also lose several of the states. She was in North Carolina earlier today, urging her supporters to come out and vote. Washington Post says, despite polls showing her leading a number of races. The Post says, among Republicans, the day's contest offered a chance for billionaire Donald Trump's remaining rivals to finally slow his march to the nomination with two winner-take-all contests that have particularly high stakes for a pair of favorite sons, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Then again, you've got Illinois, North Carolina, Missouri, also up for grabs on the Republican side. Those are proportional delegates. There's an opportunity for, in Missouri at least, for a candidate to win all of the delegates that are at play if they were to win all of the congressional districts. It gets confusing. We need to have Michael Barone on, it seems like every day, just providing color commentary for all of the election rules. But you've got a couple of winner-take-all states tonight. You've got a couple that are proportionally allocated. And interestingly enough, you know, there is, I kind of assumed as well that we're now moving into that part of the election cycle where more of these states become winner-take-all. That was the sort of the trade-off, right? If you're not one of the early states where you have the media attention maybe focused on you and you wait until later on in the election cycle, then you have more of a chance to sway the actual process because your delegates aren't awarded proportionally. Now, apparently there are some late states that actually award their delegates proportionally as well. So it is going to likely be a very confusing few hours this evening, at least until we see some of the results shake out. We'll talk again with Andrew Langer about what the landscape might look like after the Super Tuesday results come in. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this. Sitting down with us as well, NRA Iowa Executive Director Chris Cox. Chris, how are you, sir?
Cam, I'm doing well. It's great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you here. We were just listening to Wayne LaPierre get the crowd on their feet, talking about the importance of this year's election and making sure that a Clinton does not return to the White House to go after our rights once again. We were just talking with David again about how it was back in the 1990s. Here you have Hillary Clinton.
He's younger.
On the campaign stump right now, saying that she's going to go after the NRA. She wants to make sure that the NRA doesn't exist anymore, right? She wants to end the NRA. What's your response to Hillary Clinton? And what's your message to gun owners and NRA members?
Well, I had a couple takeaway from Wayne's speech today. And one was that no matter what they say and no matter how long they say it, their dishonesty proves over and over again that we're right. You saw the young Wayne talking about a lack of prosecutions, a young Wayne speaking what all people all across the country already know, and it's that we need to focus on people who are causing problems and leave those of us alone who aren't. So just the basic fundamental premise of gun control being a failure was reinforced and has been reinforced not only throughout the last 20, 25 years, but throughout the history of the world, that it's a failed policy, it's a failed idea. And the other thing is that just like the past history of this country, we have an opportunity to do something about it, that it's not too late. That as Americans, we have the ability to participate, but we have to participate. This is an election where no one gets to sit on the sidelines. This is not an election where we can sit around afterwards and complain about the results, because the results are going to be so damaging to this country and so damaging to the core principles that make this country great, that what we do between now and Election Day really will mean the difference of what this country is going to look like for the next 40 or 50 years. This is an election with long-term consequences based on, Wayne talked about it, with regards to the Supreme Court. This balance of the basic right to own a firearm, we won that court case 5-4. One vote, we no longer have 5-4 based on the tragic loss of Justice Scalia. So literally, the stakes of this election just got higher.
And Mrs. Clinton's comment and her reaction to the Heller decision, which is the decision that Chris is talking about, is that she wants a Supreme Court that will reverse it. Yeah. And yet she says she believes really down deep in firearms ownership as long as it's got common sense restrictions. That decision had one simple question that it answered. Those who favored the decision that came out, the five justices, said, yes, the Constitution means that individual, private American citizens have a right to keep and bear arms, to own firearms. The other side, the four votes, said, no, it doesn't. And what Mrs. Clinton is saying is that she does not believe that anybody in your audience has a right to own or to use a firearm for any legitimate purpose.
And that's probably the most honest thing she said in years.
That's exactly right.
Because it was a moment of honesty.
And as a result, what's happened in the importance of this election, to use a poker analogy, is everybody is all in. Yeah. The chips are all on the table.
Yeah.
If Mrs. Clinton wins, you can bet that there will be an assault like we've never seen before on the Second Amendment. And with the death of Justice Scalia, a real tragedy, not just for Second Amendment believers, but for believers in freedom and the Constitution, with the death of Justice Scalia, she would have the power on day one to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court who would, in fact, effectuate the reversal of Heller and declare the Second Amendment basically void. That's how important this election is.
This is not NRA making this up. These are the words of Justice Ginsburg, who spoke not long after the Heller decision came down to a group at the National Press Club. I mean, this is not a private event where she said she looked forward to the day that a future wiser court came back and overturned these controversial 5-4 decisions like Heller. She said that this basic right to own a firearm was controversial and needed to be overturned, and if Hillary Clinton wins, she's going to get her wish. And what that does is it's much bigger than teaching our kids that there's no individual right to own a firearm in textbooks. This will set this freedom in this country back 50 years, if not forever. So we have not only an opportunity in this election, we have a responsibility. If you, whether you own guns or not, if you care about the basic right to choose for yourself, whether or not you want to engage in the shooting sports, choose for yourself whether or not you want to keep a firearm to defend yourself, or you just think that women in this country ought to be able to make that decision themselves, this is an election you have to participate in.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty is with us on the program. Andrew, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
You know, I was doing all right. I just found out they're apparently making Indiana Jones 5.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, that would be depressing.
Yeah, that, you know, Hollywood.
But is it going to be, is it going to be Harrison Ford or is it going to be Chris Pratt?
No, it's going to be Harrison Ford.
All right, because I heard a rumor that Chris Pratt was going to do it. Listen, we have a philosophy in our family. We call, Shia LaBeouf. We call him Shia LaBeouf movie killer. Because whatever movies he happens to be in, he wholesale destroys franchises. So, you know, listen, it was all over for us when he was in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, that... I mean, how you go from, you know, what was the last one was Sean Connery, right? It was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
No. Well, the one before that.
The
yes.
one before that, right. So you go from was... you go from Harrison yeah. Ford starring with Sean Connery as his dad to Shia LaBeouf as his son. You're right. I mean, that's just that's a drop off right
to
there.
To quote Johnny Carson, it's kind of like Darwinism in reverse.
There you go. So Indiana Jones 5 might be the first Indiana Jones movie that I do not see in the movie theater.
You know, it's too bad because the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles had such they were for the most part pretty good TV fodder. I don't know if you ever caught any of those.
I did.
Yeah, you
and
know,
they were
that
good.
That was pretty good.
It was not bad at all, as a matter of fact, yeah. as far as TV shows go. Now, if you're interested in the Young remakes, Sonny Bunch at the Free Beacon just tweeted out that the Young Han Solo movie is still moving forward as well, apparently. So,
well, that's good because you know we needed that. Lord knows there was that sort of bootleg script that was floating around a long time ago. We're talking 20, 25 years ago of the prequels in which they talked about a young Han Solo being sort of a steward on some ancient space liner. Anyway, you know, I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to Rogue One this fall, which they're saying, or this December, which they're saying is going to be a Star Wars meets Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, all right. That could be interesting. I watched the new Star Wars movie. I found it okay. It was okay. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't Phantom Menace. But, I don't know. Maybe at this point we're just so many movies in that it is very clearly a franchise. It seems to me it's just lost a little bit of the magic.
See, I was all in. I'm all in for Force Awakens. I loved it. Saw it three times. To contemplating whether or not I'm going to see it a fourth time.
Wow.
But you know something, I'm someone who hated the prequels. But yeah, I loved them. I thought they were fit. But I know that there are violent disagreements. Heck, my brother was down over the weekend with his wife, and he and I got into a very heated discussion over whether or not Force Awakens was a great movie or if it was really just a rehashing of the original Star Wars.
I say rehash. I side, I think, with your brother there. But, you know, listen, speaking of very heated discussions,
and rehashes,
right? Let's talk about the primaries today. Heated discussions, I don't even think that puts it mildly. If you know, you're talking politics with anybody, if you're paying any attention online, it seems like things are just melting down right about now. And this is a very critical day for a lot of campaigns, is it not?
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, the person it's most critical for is Ted Cruz. You know, Ted Cruz has to perform. Donald Trump has to underperform. That underperformance has to gin in Ted Cruz's favor. Obviously, listen, we could talk about Marco Rubio and John Kasich. They are really only playing the role of spoilers. But if Ted's campaign has any viability, then he has to overperform today and at the disadvantage of Donald Trump in order for his campaign to continue. But then again, Donald Trump really does have to run the table in order for him to really consider today a success.
Okay, so Ohio and Florida, these are winner-take-all contests, right?
Yeah, yes.
Then North Carolina, Illinois, and Missouri, these are all proportionally decided?
They are, yes.
Okay, but there's an opportunity, at least in Missouri, for a candidate to sweep all of the delegates, depending on how they do across the state.
Well, yeah, I mean, the better they do, though I think, you know, given the way the polling looks right now, I don't see any one candidate, you know, rising up and making Missouri a winner-take-all. Though if Ted Cruz were able to do that, it really would sort of blunt it. Now, the battleground here really is Ohio, and you know, that's where Trump and Kasich really are neck and neck. Rubio, with his sort of move, we'll see if it works out, to ask his supporters to go and vote for Kasich. Which to me is a sign of real, you know, maturity, even though these things almost never work out the way the candidates want them to. But, you know, that's really where the battle is. Unless, of course, you somehow Ted Cruz pulls a Bernie Sanders and stunningly upsets Trump in Florida, I think it's pretty much a guarantee. And then still Trump doesn't have the nomination necessarily locked up, even if he does run the table today. He still has a substantial – if he runs the table today, he'll end the night with over 800 delegates. And that's, you know, he has to get another 437 delegates. So after today, 937 delegates are up for grabs. So Trump would have to win just under half of those in order to get the Republican nomination before July. And that's obviously that's very much possible, but he has to run the table today. It's all so complicated. And let's not forget, Cam, that Trump starts the day already ahead of the game, because the Northern Marianas Islands voted today, and he won 9 delegates. Trump won all 9 delegates from there.
That is true. And, at this point, if you are it seems like at this point every delegate counts now, right? Because it's all about getting to 1237.
No, that's exactly it. You have to get to 1237, and every delegate does count. And as we've long said, you know, any delegate that doesn't go to Trump is a delegate against Trump, and that's the point. And it's funny, because I go both ways as to whether or not this is going to be – whether or not a brokered convention or an open convention would be a disaster. I'm not entirely certain that it would be the disaster that some folks are predicting it to be, especially given the fact that we still don't know. We know that Hillary Clinton is on course to get the requisite delegates to secure the Democratic nomination. Whether or not she actually gets that nomination is another question entirely.
No, that's a very good point. Again, we still, as you say, we don't know what's going to come of the FBI investigation. And, you know, a lot of those delegates that Hillary has right now, these are super delegates who are not officially committed, right? I mean, they can change their mind. They may have come out and said, I'm supporting Hillary Clinton right now. But if by the time the Democratic convention is held, Bernie Sanders has a leader is right there neck and neck with Hillary Clinton, these superdelegates are not bound.
Yeah, listen, here's the reality. As Curly Hoagland, who's a Republican RNC member from North Dakota, wrote over the weekend, the reality is, regardless of the so-called quote-unquote rules mm-hmm. That apply and bind delegates to candidates, the reality is, I mean, there's no real enforcement mechanism if a delegate becomes faithless in either the Republican or Democratic conventions. I mean, I would suggest that there may be a certain mortal danger, and I mean that in a very literal sense, given how nasty and violent Democratic politics can get. I would suggest that maybe there's a certain mortal danger if one becomes a faithless delegate or superdelegate on the Democratic side. But certainly on the Republican side, there's no real enforcement mechanism if ultimately a delegate decides, even on the first ballot, to not vote for their particular candidate. I mean, it may earn them scorn and ostracization from other Republicans, but the reality is a vote cast is a vote cast, and that's what really binds it, is how the vote is cast.
All right, let's talk, if we can, for a couple minutes about what's going on the Democratic side here. Again, all expectations are that Hillary Clinton is going to win Florida fairly handily, but then the questions are what happens for Bernie Sanders in places like Illinois and Ohio. He had that kind of surprise win in Michigan. Is he able to capture the Rust Belt states? And, you know, the polling that has been, in some cases, wildly inaccurate this cycle, Andrew, shows Bernie Sanders closing in on Hillary Clinton. So
And I think it's entirely likely that Bernie Sanders does pick up some delegates in any of these states. And I would not count out Florida. I mean, listen, we know that the polling in places like Florida tends to be a little bit more accurate. I'm not sure why we've seen such extraordinary things in some of the upper Midwestern states. But that being said, anything really can happen. Let's sort of put not too fine a point on the upper Midwest and frankly more of these Midwestern states and some of the Appalachian states as well. You know, Hillary Clinton didn't do herself any favors over the weekend when talking about trade and talking about jobs, when she said she was going to shut down the coal industry and said shut down coal mining jobs. That tends to have a reaction not just in coal country, but other places as well, you know, places that use coal, that have inexpensive energy because of coal, but also places that have workers that sort of see this and say, well, wait a minute. If she's willing to go after their jobs and shut down their jobs, and she's supposedly pro-worker, you know, what's to say that she's not going to sort of sacrifice my job on the altar of political expediency? So, this is why Bernie Sanders is gaining traction, because while we all know deep down inside that Bernie Sanders is going to shut down the coal industry in America, he's not so stupid as to get out there and actually say, hey, yeah, I'm going to shut down coal mining jobs. And interestingly enough, Cam, it does put the United Mine Workers in the very awkward position come November, should Hillary Clinton get the nomination, of having to decide whether or not they're going to support Hillary, who is pro-organized labor, or Donald Trump, who's going to be pro-coal and pro-American coal mining.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, when I saw the headlines about Hillary's comments about that, I thought, okay, I got to listen to this. It can't be as bad as that. And it really was as bad as that. We're going to shut down these coal companies. We're going to shut down these coal jobs. She said, we're not going to forget about the people in these communities. We're going to retrain them, right? We're going to make sure they have other opportunities. Now, she didn't say what those opportunities were.
Yeah, this is exactly, and anybody needs to point out to exactly what happened with the Clinton administration in the 90s and the supposedly retrained lumber workers up in the Pacific Northwest whose jobs were eviscerated because of the northern spotted owl.
They were not all trained as wildlife biologists?
Yes, they were all trained as biologists and eco-tourist leaders and a whole bunch of other things. And Lord knows we've seen a booming economy up in the Pacific Northwest as a result of it.
I believe what Hillary Clinton is going to do in coal country is she's going to establish Toastmaster chapters to teach people how to be public speakers. And then she's going to get them all $200,000 a gig speaking gigs at on Wall Street.
Well, one can only hope. Of course, she doesn't really want that competition, I don't think.
Yeah, that's a good point. At least well, that's true. Yeah, so maybe not Wall Street. Maybe, you know, just we'll set up the Toastmasters. We'll start there, and then the gigs will just flow in.
Well, I mean, listen, Kim, the reality is it is pretty much what Reagan said, which is to say that, you know, when something's successful, you tax it. When it remains viable, you regulate it. And then when it dies, you subsidize it. So I mean, we know what they're going to do is they're going to kill the jobs and they're going to put everybody onto some sort of form of public assistance, you know, without the retraining and essentially make them all dependent upon the government itself, and the cycle will continue. So when she says she's not going to forget about them, that's really what she what she means. But the bottom line here is it's all going to be about destroying those jobs.
Talking again with Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Unfortunately, Andrew, we have got to run. The hour is almost over, but I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And enjoy Star Wars if you go see it for a fourth time.
And buckle up, folks, because it's going to be a wild night.
Yes, indeed. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Hopefully you already had your seatbelts buckled at this point in the electoral process, because not only is it going to be a wild night tonight, it has been a fairly wild ride for quite some time, and I don't see it getting any calmer anytime soon. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League is going to join us next hour. Also, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will be with us with a Nanny State update. Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, all coming up top of Hour 3. Also, Dan Bongino, former Secret Service agent, writing a conservative review on the ICE statistics. 124 illegal immigrants released from jail here in the United States, later charged, and 138 murders. Plus, we'll get the latest on background check referendums in Nevada. Stick around. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up next.
I'm here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Fires Museum. Ashley, good to see you again, and thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah, we don't have any guns today.
I know, that's okay. We're going to talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man. The Cody Firearms Museum is actually one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library, and there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms, and they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how they're such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from
1425.
Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me, because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company. And so they collected international firearms. They collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, with 1425. And so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West. And so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to tell, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with you, Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contest or anything?
It's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You want to loan it over here? Loan that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But, you know, what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some... I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had... Right now, they're displaying Eisenhower's... One of Eisenhower's guns and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we.
I was like,
we did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have, so stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum, and it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster, and, you know, first off, I mean, you know, the 61's great, and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it, and then it also... We knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to like a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861. And his name was Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in the American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it. And then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it just doesn't get much
awesome.
Better.
Awesome. How can we get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA
thank
News.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Talking on the program this hour with our friend Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League up in Massachusetts. There is more action on that proposed gun ban in Lexington, Massachusetts. Got a town meeting coming up in early April, and there is a proposal, again, on the books to ban semi-automatic rifles, to ban magazines over 10 rounds. This would require approval from the state attorney general, and the town selectmen aren't really sure that they're going to get that approval from the attorney general. So there is a bit of a push there in Lexington. Would you consider maybe a non-binding resolution saying that the state should ban these guns? Maybe not even that. You know, there was a Board of Selectmen's meeting in Lexington last week, and you had hundreds of individuals show up to speak out about that proposed gun ban. The vast majority of them are there to speak out in opposition to this proposed gun ban, and most of those in attendance were actually from Lexington itself, but not a huge community. But there's a lot of passion about this. There are a lot of folks who say, listen, we live in Lexington, Massachusetts, for goodness sake. You know, this was where the War of Independence began, when the British were marching to Concord, Massachusetts to search for arms. They ran across militia members there on the green at Lexington on their way to Concord. And that's where the first shots of the War of Independence broke out. Why on earth would we try to ban firearms, commonly owned firearms, from lawful citizens here in Lexington? Sends kind of the wrong message. Then you have the argument made by other gun owners there and other residents. I don't even know if they're gun owners, but other residents in Lexington saying, we don't have a crime problem here. And those guns aren't used in crime. So why are we going after people who aren't committing violent crimes and telling them that they can't own these firearms that they currently already own? You didn't see a lot of support for the proposed gun ban there in Lexington, except from the guy who is trying to ban the firearms there in Lexington, Massachusetts. The Boston Globe had a story about this a couple of days ago. They've got an update on this story today. Robert Rotberg is the guy who was proposing the gun ban. He is a member of the town meeting. He is also the founding director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Program on Intrastate Conflict, and he is president emeritus of the World Peace Foundation. And he says he wants to have a poll now. He's reached out to town meeting members asking, do we as a body want to defy the gun lobby and pass a ban against assault weapons in Lexington? Or would you prefer moving forward with a non-binding, modest resolution to the legislature that could accomplish less than an outright ban? Or would you put this off and definitely postpone the proposal while residents have a, quote, intensive townwide conversation about guns? Apparently saying, Robert, no, is not an option in this poll that Robert has put together. There is no option of, Robert, we've had the conversation, and we reject your idea of a gun ban, but thank you for your service at the town meeting. Apparently that is not an option there in the poll. He says, I'm hopeful that I will have sufficient replies within a few days to constitute a meaningful opinion poll, and then we will be able to decide what to do.
which is kind of weird if you think about it, because why are you polling members of the town meeting when you're having the town meeting, which is supposedly, again, one of the a great small D democratic features of New England society. You have the town meeting once a year. Members of the town come together to discuss issues important to the town. And they vote on these issues as a town. Here we've got some pre-town meeting politicky going on here. Rotberg says that he will share the results of the town meeting member poll with supporters, not with everybody, just with his supporters, and hopes to have a decision by midweek, so maybe tomorrow, maybe Thursday, as to whether there is support for a vote on the proposed bylaw which would ban the sale, manufacture, or possession of, quote, assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in town. Rotberg says that the proposed law would not take all guns out of the hands of properly licensed gun owners in Lexington, just some of them, and the ones that he really doesn't like. The Boston Globe says, according to a memo to the Board of Selectmen from the town's legal firm, Anderson and Krieger LLP, while the ban would be likely permissible under the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, this based on the Supreme Court not hearing a challenge to the very similar ban in Highland Park, Illinois, it, quote, would likely be disapproved by the Attorney General there in Massachusetts or by a court as preempted by the Comprehensive Firearms Act, which is the state's gun control law there in Massachusetts. In addition, the memo says, the proposed bylaw would almost certainly result in a costly legal challenge. But it would make Robert, anyway, feel really good. So we have to, you know, weigh that all in the balance. On the one hand, it would probably be rejected because it violates the state's preemption law. Even if it was accepted, you'd be facing a costly legal challenge. But on the and by the way, there'd be no public benefit. No public safety benefit. But on the other hand, Robert would feel good about himself. And he might feel like they were living in a safer city or a safer town. Be no evidence that that would actually be the case, but he would feel differently. Back on March the 7th, in a earlier story, Rotberg said, quote, we're not taking anything away. No. He said, we're strengthening the rights of Lexingtonians to be secure in their private houses and less fearful of people spraying bullets at them. You know, again, it doesn't sound like people in Lexington are really afraid of that right now, given the number of people who turned out in opposition to this proposal. Meanwhile, you can look at what has happened in the state of Massachusetts since the passage of the gun control laws back in 1998. That was the big push for a statewide gun control in Massachusetts. And the number of licensed gun owners in the state plummeted after the state enacted these proposals. What did not plummet in Massachusetts or the violent crimes. The gun control laws put in place in 1998 didn't do anything to bring down the crime rate. As a matter of fact, the Boston Globe, of all places, this was a couple of years ago, had a story about how violent crime was going down in Massachusetts right up until the Gun Control Act of 1998 was passed. And then the drop kind of stopped. And now, Massachusetts has some of the most restrictive gun control laws in New England. In fact, probably the most restrictive gun control laws in New England. And the highest violent crime in New England. Weird how that works, isn't it? Okay, we'll talk about it with Jim Wallace. Julie Gunlock coming up a little bit later on in the hour as well. Now, I mentioned we're also paying attention to all of the latest legislative news from around the country. We talked a little bit last hour about the campus safety bill, the campus carry bill on Governor Deal's desk down in Georgia. Excuse me, as well as campus carry, which is progressing through the Missouri legislature. Pardon me, trying not to go into a Hillary Clinton coughing fit here. In addition to the campus carry measures, you know what, Karen? Let's just go ahead and take a break a couple minutes early. We'll talk for a few minutes after we get back before we're joined by Jim Wallace. But we've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered woman, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified.
Gosh.
Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It maybe took 2 years to get the guts to do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
You and I didn't choose to be targets in the age of terror. But innocents like us will continue to be slaughtered in concert halls, sports stadiums, restaurants, and airplanes. No amount of bloodshed will ever satisfy the demons among us. These cowards dream of inflicting more damage, more suffering, more terror. No target is too intimate or too sacred for these monsters. They will come to where we worship, where we educate, and where we live. But when evil knocks on our doors, Americans have a power no other people on the planet share. The full-throated right to defend our families and ourselves with our Second Amendment. Let fate decide if mercy is offered to the demons at our door. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, continues. Not sure if it's the allergies or just the last lingering bit of the CPAC plague there, but we will get through it. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Jim Wallace from the Gun Owners Action League will join us on the program. Also, next hour, Dan Bongino will join us on the show as well, talking about a story that was going to be one of our deals of the day yesterday. According to ICE, 124 illegal immigrants released from jail here in the United States ended up being charged in 138 different homicides around the country. Plus, we'll talk with Catherine Mortensen coming up in Hour 3 as well. In Nevada, you know, every town and Bloomberg trying to put on the ballot and have put on the ballot coming up in this November, a bill that would make it illegal to privately transfer a firearm there in the state of Nevada. Now, the anti-gun groups teaming up with some churches there around the state of Nevada. So we'll talk with Catherine Mortensen about that. Coming up here in just a couple minutes, Mr. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League discussing the upcoming potential gun ban there in Lexington, Massachusetts. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper, you know, the far-left-leaning newspaper in England, had a big story today. So, America, this is how other countries do gun control. Because you won't pass the gun control laws that that we think that you should have. We'll tell you how other countries have done it. What's fascinating is that they look at the United Kingdom, Japan, Germany, and Australia. We have heard President Obama, of course, praise Australia and the gun. You know, he didn't really praise the gun confiscation. He just praised Australia, right? Didn't want to get too specific about what they actually did in Australia. Hillary Clinton, sort of the same thing. You know, they did wonderful things there, and they haven't had any problems since. What's fascinating is that even the Guardian in England found a lot of people in that country who say that the massive anti-gun laws, banning handguns, banning semi-automatic long guns, didn't really do anything to get guns away from criminals. In fact, the Guardian pointed out that crime started going up. Firearm offenses went up in England after the gun control laws in the late 1990s. They also say, they quote Dave Thompson, the chief constable of the West Midlands, the lead on gun crime for the National Association of Chief Constables. He said the legislation coincided very well with a culture, meaning, in other words, that there was a lot of popular support at the time for this because there weren't a lot of gun owners in the United Kingdom. So no big deal, right? But the Guardian says overnight, however, about 200,000 owners of handguns, most of whom kept them for pistol shooting, found their weapon banned and their pastime wiped out. All small-bore pistols and rifles used by target shooters were included in the ban. Penalties for anyone in possession of an illegal firearm were tough, from heavy fines to prison terms of 10 years. Mike Wells, who is the secretary of the Sportsmen's Association of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, set up in 1996, said politicians have been driven by a need to show that they were doing something, but their actions did nothing to stop the criminal use of guns. He said it never has any effect. The criminal underworld in England, the drug dealers have all got guns, but they're all illegal guns. Mark Mastaglio, an expert on firearms who worked for the Forensic Science Service for 20 years in the United Kingdom, said that there was no evidence that the ban on handguns had done anything to cut the criminal use of firearms. He said, quote, it was very rare that there was ever leakage from the licensed gun owners to the criminal fraternity. Most guns used by criminals are either illegally imported or converted weapons, and that remains the case today. Huh. This is from The Guardian. One more line from The Guardian here. Crime statistics in the years after the ban was introduced appear to support the theory that it had little impact. Yeah, the handgun ban had little impact on criminals getting a hold of handguns in England. The Guardian actually said this, not the Times of London, the far left-leaning Guardian. We'll talk more about what they found in other countries as well. But right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts, Mr. Jim Wallace. Jim, how you doing, sir?
Good. Welcome back to the Second Amendment Battleground State. We always got something to talk about here, Cam.
Yeah, right. And including anti-gun proposals at the site of a real battleground there in Lexington, Massachusetts. What is the latest here, Jim? You've got the town meeting coming up in April. I know there was a Board of Selectmen's meeting in Lexington last week, and it sounds like there were a ton of gun owners and Second Amendment supporters who showed up in Lexington to speak out against this proposed ban.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting what's happening and how this thing is kind of morphing. And, you know, I guess the supporter or the filer, if you will, of this proposed ordinance, it seems like he's really taken aback by the pushback that he's getting. You know, sometimes I tell people that, you know, when somebody says they're leading the nation, sometimes you can be so far behind when you don't see somebody in front of you, you think you're leading, but you're actually not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the case here, where I think he truly expected everybody just to fall lockstep behind him and support his kind of absurd notion of what liberty is all about and start restricting lawful citizens, and they haven't. And now it's pretty clear he's not sure how to proceed, and really neither is the town from what I'm seeing. But at the Board of Selectmen's meeting, it was a resounding message from, I guess, the majority of the people, vast majority, to not proceed with this proposed amendment to redefine assault weapons and end the ban. The Board of Selectmen refused to support the proposed bylaw change, and there was even a suggestion that they make it a non-binding resolution, and the selectmen even refused to support that act. What was interesting was then the chief of police actually said that he did not support the effort, and also that if it were passed, he would not instruct his officers to enforce the law. That had to be a big blow to this person that suggested this.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, look, in a perfect world, it would be a big blow. But I'm looking here at the Boston Globe, and it sounds like, you know, not willing to accept defeat yet. It wants to poll town hall members in advance of the town meeting and ask them, do you want to go forward? Actually, let me give you the exact wording here, Jim. Do we as a body sure want to defy the gun lobby and pass a ban against assault weapons in Lexington, or would you prefer to move forward with a modest resolution to the legislature that could accomplish less than an outright ban? It kind of sounds like we know where Robert Rotberg is coming from. Still wants to, quote, defy the gun lobby and pass a ban against assault weapons in Lexington. Here's the thing, though. I suppose you defy the gun lobby by not buying a firearm. But you would be defying state law, it sounds like, by passing this ban. You'd also be defying the will of a lot of residents there in Lexington, Massachusetts, if you pass this ban. Can you talk a little bit about the state firearms preemption law, Jim? What does state law say in Massachusetts when it comes to setting gun laws?
Well, one of the things we're actually working on is a very clear state preemption. It's unclear in Mass law that the state has that preemption in Mass, and that's why we're trying to push. The bill is actually House 2158, filed by Representative Jim Selle, and we're pushing that now constantly because of issues like this, because Lexington isn't the only one. I think we're up above a dozen cities and towns that have tried this, and we just found out about two or three more just the other day. So it's a very clear, organized effort on the local side to try to get something in place. I guess, before we're able to change the law. The other thing we're really concerned about is that, you know, the Massachusetts court system, especially the Supreme Judicial Court, has not been very friendly to the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
It has actually looked for reasons to shoot it down, no pun intended, ever since Heller and McDonald. So, you know, we don't want to count on a win there to try to help us. So we want to make sure that the state takes charge. And we're in a much bigger fight with the state, Cam. You and I have talked about this for years, about how Massachusetts has all these gun laws. They really don't have control of their system, you know, whether it's the licensing authorities, the towns, the actual laws, the approved rosters they have. They really don't have control of the system, and nobody wants to take responsibility for it. So it's kind of even a much bigger push than just the Lexington issue. But there are a lot of people talking about it across the state, saying if it did pass in Lexington, it would most likely end up in court. You know, you're talking about Second Amendment issues, probably Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues. So, you know, there's a lot here to talk about. But the other danger is, it's bad enough as a nation that we have a patchwork of laws within the states. But now to actually push that down to the town level, it would make being a gun owner completely untenable. And that's what they actually want anyway.
Well, I think you're right about that. You know, look, here's the thing. I mean, you go back and you read some of the earlier comments by Robert Rockberg, and he talked about, this isn't taking anybody away from anything, Jim. This is about ensuring that the residents of Lexington have the right to be safe in their homes without being sprayed by bullets. I think it was that's a pretty close paraphrase of something that he told the Boston Globe about a week ago. This actually is about taking things away from people. This actually is about saying to people who currently own, these firearms, you can't own them in Lexington anymore.
It's kind of interesting, Cam, because over the last couple of years when they've talked about bans like this, it's interesting because they'll tell you, well, we're not confiscating guns. We're just saying you can't have them. So
right.
It's kind of interesting how they kind of twist that language a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. You know, and the thing is, Jim, as we've talked about this program, at that Board of Selectmen's meeting last week, you had a couple of different arguments being raised against this. You certainly had folks say, look, this seems really weird for us to be banning guns in Lexington, Massachusetts, given the history of the town. But you also had people pointing out, you know, look, there are people who own these firearms. We're not committing violent crimes. Lexington is not a violent place. Why are you coming after us? Why are we, the law-abiding legal gun owners, the target here, as opposed to focusing on the people who are actually committing violent crimes in the state of Massachusetts?
Yeah, and really they did hammer home that point that it's actually a situation where they're pitting neighbor against neighbor. And nobody's done anything wrong, but you have somebody who has a very clear political agenda, who clearly supports anti-civil rights measures against gun owners, and will use the terminology to demonize both the gun owners, the guns they own, and the organization that protects their civil rights. And you can tell by the language that Mr. Rockberg uses that he's completely bigoted against all of us in the firearms community and wants us gone and considers us a blight on the landscape of Lexington. So it's kind of interesting to see the fact that, you know, the citizens just aren't standing for it. You know, you're not going to pit us against each other. You're not going to tell me my neighbor who's been a good friend and lawful citizen for years is suddenly an imminent threat to public safety in Lexington. And can you please show me a gun that sprays bullets at a house in Lexington? Because, you know, that's a very bad thing. And if it's happening, I'm sure law enforcement would want to know about it.
I am sure you're right. So, Jim, in advance of the town meeting on April the 6th, what, you know, obviously gun owners in Lexington, you should show up for the town meeting. But, you know, is this appropriate for gun owners outside of the town to weigh in on this issue?
Well, I think it is. Just, you know, obviously, you know, make sure you do so in an adult and professional way. You know, state your case. They should know that people outside of Lexington are concerned, not only just as citizens, but for people who visit Lexington on a regular basis or happen to drive through Lexington on a regular basis. Since there are several big arteries, highways that go through there, you would be subject to these laws if they're passed. And just in keeping of the civil rights of our country, that you may be concerned about what may be happening in what is considered the birthplace of freedom for our country. So I think it's very important that they reach out. And the other thing, Ken, that's interesting is the moderator is actually starting to reach out to people to let them know how they're going to run things, and even if they're going to vote on this. So it's going to be kind of interesting.
That really is. All right. Well, listen, Jim, I know we'll be talking again about this very issue, if not before April the 6th, certainly after the town meeting is held. Before we let you go, I also got to ask you about another story here from the south area south of Boston, a story about the growing number of Class A license holders in the state of Massachusetts. Now, this is, I guess, not particularly surprising to you, but it is, I think, surprising to a lot of people who think that, you know, gun ownership has been, in essence, banned in the state of Massachusetts. No, Massachusetts, just like a lot of other states around the country, seen more gun owners and more people who are carrying firearms.
The numbers have actually rebounded a lot in the last 5 or 6 years. We have seen it at Gold through our training programs. And our affiliated clubs are telling us the same thing, that they just can't keep up with the demand for firearms training, both for basic firearms training, which you have to have in Massachusetts to get your license, but also for more advanced training, which is always a good thing. I think it's kind of interesting if you have the article there, the quote from John Rosenthal in Stop Handgun Violence, that the so-called gun lobby actually fosters gun violence because it sells more guns or something to that effect.
Oh, here it is. Yes. John Rosenthal from Stop Handgun Violence says that increased gun ownership heightens the risk of accidents and violence. He said the reality is the gun industry and the gun lobby they support want more gun violence. So people are more afraid and buy guns, which results in more violence and more fear. It's a complete fallacy that a gun makes you safer, he said. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's So the people within the industry, the NRA members actually want more violence, so people are more afraid and buy guns. You know, it's interesting, Jim. There have been lots of Americans who've been buying firearms as the violent crime rate has been dropping in this country.
Yeah, isn't it curious that the only organizations that actually teach firearm safety, promote firearm safety, promote responsible ownership of firearms, are the ones that are accused of fostering violence. Maybe somebody should open the door and let some sunlight in to stop gun violence, where they can actually see what's going on across the country. But you and I, Cam, we both know some people, it does not matter how many facts you put in front of them. You can put all the numbers in front of them. You can put all the facts in front of them. They have an agenda. They don't care. And, you know, one of the terms I've started to use, Cam, and it's spreading across the country and other people are using it, is out-and-out bigotry against gun owners, because that's what this is. It's people like John Rosenthal who spread false lies in hopes to gain a fear of the gun owner and a hatred of the gun owner. That's exactly what these folks are doing, and I call it for what it is, absolute bigotry.
Jim Wallace with the Gun Owners Action League. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure, and I hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Hey, thanks, and go Sox. Open the day pretty quick, huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Go Sox. We'll talk to you soon, Jim.
Bye.
All right. Thank you, sir. Let's see. Before we take a timeout, we've got Julie Gunlock coming up from the Independent Women's Forum. And the Washington Post, a story by Allison Barrett Carter, a freelance writer in North Carolina. No, she says, you can't carry concealed weapons into our child-proof, gun-free home. I wasn't asking. But we'll talk about that coming up as well. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other, and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised $12,000. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you mm-hmm. thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago, 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling
right.
our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, oh, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, So I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids,
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up top of the hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Dan Bongino. Writing that conservative review, Catherine Mortensen coming up next hour. Going to talk about what's going on in Nevada, as well as the latest with the campus safety bill there in Georgia. Right now, though, want to get to our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, who joined us in studio earlier today for a Nanny State update. Take a look and a listen. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, thank you for joining us in studio once again.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I am very excited because later in the week, I get to say, Julie Gunlock, thanks for joining us at the range, because we are going to the NRA range with several of your colleagues from the Independent Women's Forum. Who exactly is going to join us? Do you know?
Yeah, I do. Ashley Carter, who runs our Independent Women's Network, which is our sort of our collection of clubs around the country. And Celia Myers, who works in communication. And Amber Schwartz, who does all of our development and fundraising. So those are the three. And then, of course, Jen is going to join us.
Jen Jakes.
Yay!
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms is going to be there as well. Yeah, I'm excited too. This is going to be a lot of fun. You'll be able to see this on NRANews.com at some point in the near future. I think Cecilia's had some experience shooting before, right?
No, Celia definitely will be bringing her own gun. So she definitely has experience. And I've actually done quite a bit of shooting in my lifetime. I shouldn't say that. I should say I've never done it again. I've done it before in case I really blow it. I think I think most of us have some experience. So hopefully we won't embarrass you.
Good. Well, there's no embarrassing. It's just, it's a good time, but we are going to go through the safety course beforehand for those who need the refresher course. But, I'm really looking forward to it. We've been talking about doing this for a while, so I'm glad we can actually get this going here.
Yeah.
All right. So Independent Women's Forum actually put out a statement this week on something I have to confess, Julie, I know nothing about. Jessica Alba and her booming baby business, Honesty, right?
No,
this
honest.
Is what it's called, the Honest Company.
Honest? Yeah. Yes.
It's just called Honest. Are you accusing the Honest of being dishonest?
I'm not. But people are starting to get a little frustrated with these companies that market themselves as, so much more wholesome or so much safer. And so the Wall Street Journal did this piece looking at the makeup of some of her products. And look, if your viewers or listeners are not familiar with the Honest Company, this was founded by a Hollywood actress named Jessica Alba. Very popular actress. She's very pretty. And she started this company called The Honest Company. And I've written about her before. I've written pieces in the New York Post. She markets her, as I said earlier, she markets her company as being more, honest, that the ingredients are more wholesome and, safer. And that's just not true. Many of her products contain chemicals. She says they're chemical free. They're not. They contain fragrances and other things. And so Wall Street Journal did a piece and analyzed one of her products, and they found that she is using a chemical that she says she does not use. Now, there's nothing wrong with this chemical. It's safe, and her products are completely safe. That's not the point. But it reveals a little bit of her marketing strategy. And so, I just try to point out to people, her products are extremely expensive. And so again, she says, well, but you get a safer product. That's not actually true. And the products that are in the marketplace that are come at a cheaper price, they are just as safe. And look, there's mechanisms in place. Consumers need to know there are mechanisms in place that if a product does make it to store shelves and there's suddenly people get sick from it or there's these massive allergic reactions, that product is going to be pulled. There are mechanisms. There are agencies that oversee this stuff. So, this article came out calling her on a little bit of the dishonesty, the marketing tactics used, and so we issued a statement to back that up, to say that you really owe it to your consumers or to your customers to be honest about products and not scare them into paying more for products that are actually available at a much more reasonable price.
And you still know, awake? This is not some. Yeah, I am still awake. Absolutely. No, this is fascinating to me because this is not what I didn't realize is that this isn't some little thing here. A $1.7 billion.
She's on the cover of Fortune magazine. Yeah, she was on the cover.
So
yes,
this is a big deal. And again. And as you say, the whole branding of this company is things you can trust, right? Products you can trust.
Right.
They're better for you.
Right.
Sure, you're paying more, but that's because you're paying for quality. And what the Wall Street Journal and these independent tests showed is that, you're actually getting the exact same thing.
Getting the exact same
thing. That you could be getting for a lot less, right?
Yeah,
that this is...
I get so frustrated. You know, right now I'm looking at summer camps. I'm probably in the same position as a lot of moms. I'm looking at summer camps. Gosh, they are so expensive, right? And I'm trying to sort of figure out what the kids are, I want to join a pool, cause it gets them some exercise and they love the pool. And then I'm looking at the camps and it's really tough. It's really tough to budget for this stuff. And, I think about how, I'm lucky that I know that there are products in the grocery store and that, for instance, conventionally grown food. I don't shop at Whole Foods. I don't shop for this expensive food. So I'm able to save money in these little ways. I'm a good cook, so I can make cheap food taste good. And I don't sort of fall for that marketing that one particular kind of food is safer. And then again, with these products, I know that there are cleaning materials and personal care products that I don't go for that, the boutique things or the things that are organic, because I know that the cheaper things are perfectly safe. And so I'm able to save money. And I think about parents and moms who really stress out about this and feel like, oh gosh, maybe this stuff is dangerous. Maybe I do need to buy organic food, or maybe I do need to, buy this expensive product to keep my kids safe. It really comes sort of clearer to me what people struggle with and their budgets. And if they could, if they could save money in these little ways, that adds up. And so, I think there's an awful lot of misleading marketing out there. And it really takes a toll on people's budgets.
It does. And as you say, there's also the peer pressure. There is the culture of alarmism that this contributes to. And frankly, it's just kind of sad to see this pitch being made from a company called Honest Company.
Yeah, it's nice.
Right?
Nice touch.
Right. Just kind of digs in a little bit deeper. It's fascinating that you actually that you and the Independent Women's Forum brought this up, because, like I said, I had not heard of this. I found it really, really interesting.
Oh, thanks.
And as you said, you are looking at summer camps for the kids. I'd like you to know Uncle Cam's Goat Corral. We've got very affordable rates for the summer.
Oh, right. Gosh, I might just take you up on that. Can I drop? Is it a sleepaway camp?
It can be. We can talk about that.
Excellent.
You kids have any goat allergies or anything
Nothing.
Like that?
And I don't care
good?
If they do. They'll be fine.
Okay. All right. And they're hard workers.
We can
work them for, five, 6 hours.
There's a little bit of whining.
Okay.
There's a little whining, but they'll be fine.
That's to be expected.
Yeah.
All right. That is good to know.
I don't know the wine for Cool Cam Edwards. I don't know the wine for you. They wine for Mom. I don't know. They probably would try to be a little more, they'd probably try to get
sure.
along a little bit.
Well, that's how you know that you're raising your kids right, if they actually know that, here's another grown-up. I need to behave.
Right.
I need to look better. My kids, right? I drop my kids off, and I'm always
great.
Talking to the parents. I'm like, all right, let me know.
Right.
Let me know. Right. And then I come back. Oh, they were fantastic.
What?
Well, that's good. I'm glad to know that they can clean up their act every
now
and then.
Right.
So speaking of whining, before we let you go, I've got to ask, have you been keeping up with the latest a campus insanity with the you've got in USC, they're trying to impeach someone, head of the College Republicans, who's also a student senator for the thought crime of bringing Milo Yiannopoulos to campus. Well, Julie, are you concerned? I mean, I know your kids aren't ready for college yet, unless you've got some Doogie Howsers on your hands. But
no.
As you look at what's going on these campuses, are you a little freaked out, a little concerned as a parent?
Bethany Mandel, who I know has been a guest on the show, she's all over Twitter, and she said something the other day. She said, let's do home school or home college. Let's start it. Let's start home college. I mean, I am genuinely panicked about this. Now, you know that that's never going to happen for me, but I am genuinely freaked out about this. I'm generally freaked out about, this culture that's, I think I've talked to you about this before. It's almost like the Red Army, like the students are taking over and the professors cannot be relied on and college leadership cannot be relied on to set these kids straight. In fact, they bow to them. They say, oh, you know, what can we do? What policies, what totally insane policies can we institute to make you feel better? And so there's no leadership. There's no grown up on campus anymore. And the kids are more and more in control, and we're seeing these kinds of really insane policies that really make me nervous for sending my kids to school. I hope they like car mechanic. I hope they become car mechanics or like, you know, pick up a trade that they don't. Yeah, I do not want to send my kids into that kind of environment.
You know, you're not alone, certainly. and you know, look, we've talked with our kids, and you know, we've basically said, yay for trade schools. You know, those are good things. Consider trade schools. My oldest son doesn't really know what he wants to do. He was thinking about being a plumber for a long time, and I'm still encouraging
lucrative.
That. But I've said, you know, listen, you can work, you can go to community college, but we're not going to send you off to a four-year institution right now unless you can tell me, you know, that you want to do something that's going to actually get you a job, a degree that's going to have a future. And otherwise, you know, listen, there is absolutely nothing wrong with joining the military. There's nothing wrong with learning a trade. In fact, those are very good things. So you're not alone. But, you know, at the same time, do you ever think, Julie, well, maybe we need to be raising our kids to go off to campus to fight this? Or is that kind of like fighting City Hall? You're just sending your lamb off to slaughter.
Look, I agree with you. And I think that's why you do see the popularity of other schools like Liberty University or like Hillsdale and schools that really are not like this. And so, I mean, that's one thing you can send them sort of into the lion's den and hope that they affect change. But you know, I think a lot of parents are like, what's the point? And are they actually going to learn anything in that environment? You know, you also have other situations. There's a fellow at IWF who just wrote this great piece about nursing certifications and how now that the nursing industry is insisting that nurses not only get associate's degree, but a four-year degree. And that is really contributing to the nursing shortage. And so you actually have sort of among certain industries, this is sort of a professional recommendation. You have pushing for four-year degrees when before a two-year associate's degree was adequate. And so that puts a lot more pressure, particularly on, I think, kids coming out of poor areas that they might be able to get an associate's degree and then launch right into work. And now they have the pressure of going to a four-year institution, accepting all of that debt. So you actually have within certain professions this idea that everyone has to have these four-year bachelor's degrees. So it's a problem not only on college campuses, but it's a problem within certain professions that are insisting on this higher level of education when it's really not needed, when a two-year degree plus certifications will be just fine. And we should encourage that. We should really encourage that and stop with this sort of education snobbery, which is what it amounts to.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. Listen, Julie, I will see you later in the week. Thank you again for coming in studio. It's always a pleasure.
I'm glad to be on. Thanks. I can't wait to see you on Friday.
We'll see you soon. Julie Gundlach with the Independent Women's Forum. You can find them at IWF.org. All right. Coming up top of the hour, we have the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. As I mentioned at the Washington Post, Allison Barrett Carter, a freelance writer down in North Carolina, has a piece out. No, you can't carry concealed weapons into our child-proofed gun-free home. Now, she says, before we start quoting the Second Amendment, I am not writing an anti-gun article. Okay. Family and friends are completely free to legally get their guns, take the appropriate class, and carry their guns with them, at least until such time as the country collectively decides to change any laws. Oh, well, that's nice to know that people are free to exercise their rights, because we've got permission by Allison. She says, just don't carry the gun into my home. Nope. Okay. Now, she says, even quite a few of our family members have surprised us by becoming gun hobbyists in the past few years. Owning Smith & Wessons, they received permits to have on them at all times. Luckily, she says, my husband and I are on the same page. And oh, so by the way, Allison notes that this phenomena is real. Even she is noticing people who weren't gun owners becoming gun owners and concealed carry holders down there in North Carolina. She says, luckily, my husband and I are on the same page, and our family members have respected our decision. It has been pleasantly easy, and we deemed it necessary to have conversations with our kin. But it is not so easy to talk about this with the mommies group that I invite over for a play date or the plumber coming to check my toilet. So starting at my front door, what rights do I have to keep others from bringing their concealed weapons into my house? Do we start frisking people who want to visit? Well, again, I suppose that's up to you, Allison. Maybe a sign that that maybe a gun-free zone sign posted right outside the front door. This home is gun-free, and that way everybody knows. She says, after seeking ways that I could make my house rules clear and enforceable, I was hopeful that I could simply post a no weapons allowed decal on my front door. Mm-hmm. That would make my intentions clear while simultaneously avoiding awkward situations. It was the ultimate passive way to accomplish what I wanted. But Allison says what I've read is that this is not necessarily legally binding and may not even be honored. Okay, that's for businesses, Allison. You know, if you want to post your business as gun-free, there are signs that you have to post. Your own private home, however, is a little bit different. We'll delve more into what to do if you want to make your home gun-free. Coming up top of hour three, stick around. We'll be right back after this.
So I want to welcome to the program from A Girl in a Gun Club. We have founder Juliana Crowder, and we also have executive director Robin Sandoval with us. Thank you both for coming on the program. And for those who, I can't imagine there's anybody out there who doesn't know what A Girl in a Gun Club is all about, but for those who are maybe tuning in for the first time or have never seen you on the program before, can you talk about what A Girl in a Gun Club actually does?
Right. So we host chapters across the country for ladies to come out to the range for training opportunities, practice sessions, camaraderie, you know, social aspect of shooting. And a lot of the ladies that we service, almost 70% of the people who have come to us have never shot a gun before. So we are actively, you know, training these ladies and in introducing them into the gun culture and helping them figure out what their goals are, you know, what they want to achieve, and then providing them opportunities through our activities.
How big a part is the socialization?
It's extremely important. You know, women are very social creatures, and, you know, so having the camaraderie of the chapters and the clubs is very important. It's just as important as some of the training tips and educational process that we go through, because everybody wants to feel like they belong to something.
Right.
And that's what's important.
And, you know, you talk about people who are new to this, who've never shot a gun before, to know that, okay, I'm going into a community that could be very intimidating. But if it's okay, if it's other women and
right.
you and they know, okay, they're welcoming
right.
me.
Right, and that's really important, is because even, you know, some women are even afraid of other packs of women.
Right.
right? So we.
I'm
wanna...
afraid of packs of women.
So we try to make all of those events extremely welcoming. So if someone is coming for the first time and maybe doesn't know how to, you know, come alone, or we want to make her feel welcome right away, and make sure she feels like she has a friend. And then that way she's more comfortable to learn and has introduced herself to a whole new social circle that she may not have had before.
And so, Robin, this was kind of your experience, right? I mean, had you shot a gun before?
No.
You?
No. No, never. I was actually quite against guns. I definitely did not want a gun in my home. My husband had asked me. It was actually a 10-year conversation to bring a firearm into our home. And we have three children, and I was uncomfortable with it. I was very afraid. I grew up in a big city, and police were just minutes away. And
so this was not like, okay. So I had a similar experience growing up, because I did not grow up in a gun owning household. My mom and dad got divorced when I was a kid, and you know, dad never took me hunting, never took me shooting, anything like that.
Right.
So I was a grown man before I became a gun owner. And you know, when you don't grow up with
right.
that as your tradition, and you're
right.
not taught gun safety as a kid, and you don't know a whole lot.
about firearms.
It's very scary. It can be.
Right? Because most of the time that you're hearing about guns, you're hearing about them used in a crime.
Absolutely. And women come to us all the time now, a girl and a gun, and they'll say, can you believe this woman said that she would never have a gun because her child found it? And I say, of course she would feel that way. How could she not? What's on the news every night? What does she see? She doesn't see responsible gun owners. She sees these crimes and these shock stories. And what is someone who's not part of our community going to think? And that was really my experience. I got so much support from a lot of women who had a parallel journey where they were kind of the same way. They started with a lot of fear, and then they were open to the idea of a gun, and then they wanted to learn to use it, and then they wanted to do better. And, you know, it was this really big journey. And I think that's one of the things that A Girl in the Gun brings is we recognize people where they are. We invite you to where you are in your journey because we understand. And you can meet with other women. Are you afraid of having a firearm in the home with your children? Well, let's talk about that. What are your safe storage options?
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program, Dan Bongino from Conservative Review talking about the illegal immigrants released from jail. 124 of them later charged in 138 murder cases, plus Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA Media Liaison, join us later on in the hour, talking about what's going on in Nevada as every town working with churches there in the state on a ballot initiative regarding background checks. Also, we'll talk with Catherine about what's going on in Georgia, where Governor Nathan Deal has expressed some reservations about the campus carry bill that is on his desk now. We only have a few days left in the legislative session, so we'll talk with Catherine about that coming up later on in the hour. As we headed to break last hour, we were discussing this piece in the Washington Post, Allison Barrett Carter. No, you can't carry concealed weapons into our childproof, gun-free home. She says that after she and her husband had a kid, my husband and I decided when our first son came home with us from the safe little hospital where everything was pastel and rubbery that we were going to keep all guns far away from our house. Apparently, that hospital didn't have any sort of surgical implements or none of the 250,000 deaths due to medical mistakes occurred at that hospital. It's a safe little hospital where everything is pastel and rubbery. Huh. Good to know. Anyway, she said that we got home, we decided got to keep all guns far away from our house. So they told their family, don't come over with guns. They said they thought it went okay. But then they started thinking, what about people who aren't family? How do we let people know? If the mom's group comes over, if the plumber comes over, how do we let them know that this is a gun-free home? She said, I thought about putting up a sticker. I was hopeful I could simply post a no weapons allowed decal on my front door. But, she says, what I've read is that this is not necessarily legally binding and may not even be honored. In fact, she says, during my research, I found many recent articles from gun activist groups advocating that such decals be actively ignored. I don't know. She didn't provide any links to that. But it is true that if you're a business and you want to post your establishment as a place where firearms are not legally allowed, the state law varies, but you may be required to post some exact signage. A no guns allowed sign may not be legally binding depending on what state you live in, if you're a business. Now, again, if you're a homeowner, if you're talking about, you know, trying to ban guns from your home, there's no signage necessary. As a property owner, you can, again, decide how best you want to try to do that. But, yes, I suppose there would be people who might disregard your feelings. They might also see that no soliciting sign and decide to ring your doorbell. Again, there may be people who, you know, would want to burgle your home who would disregard that no guns allowed sign too. You know, there is no law that can make people comply with a decal on your door, unfortunately, no matter what the issue is. Allison Barrett Carter says, since my home is my private property, I do have some rights, of course. For example, if I discover that there is a concealed weapon in my home, I am free to threaten the carrier with trespassing charges until they leave. But even that, she says, isn't necessarily guaranteed. It requires me to know that they have a gun, first of all. Yes, it does, because otherwise, how would you know? And there seems to be some confusion, she says, about what is legally appropriate if the person still refuses to leave, not to mention that they are armed and I am now in an altercation with them. She writes, as more Americans get their concealed carry permits, the best way I can find to navigate this issue is to ask anyone before entering our house if they have a gun on them. If they refuse to leave it in their car, I can refuse them entry. She says, it won't make me friends, and play dates will now be incredibly more awkward to set up, but at least my home can stay gun-free for my kids. It is a big, ugly conversation that seems worth risking, she says. Okay. Now, again, I hate to be the one to be the bearer of bad news there for Allison, but she could ask someone, do you have a fire? Everyone coming up to the door, do you have a firearm on you? And I suppose that they could all answer honestly, yes or no. If they refuse to leave that in the car, she could refuse them entry. Now, she did say, well, what if I got into a disagreement and the person refused to leave my house if I found they had a gun? Because now they're armed and I'm in an altercation with them. So, you know, again, you're still, if you're dealing with somebody who, let's say, has ill intent, they may not abide by your request to leave their firearm before they come back in your house to rob you, for instance. But I, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, is this tongue in cheek? Is this real? That you know, you're so freaked out by the prospect of someone coming to your home, friend, family member, plumber, that you're thinking about it. How do I guarantee? How do I make sure? It's one thing to have the policy, right? How do I make sure that that policy, that my home is gun-free, is followed? And Allison Barrett Carter can't really come up with a way. Any more than campuses around the country could really guarantee. Again, you can have the policy. I don't want firearms here. But somebody who is intent on breaking that law, somebody who maybe wants to use that firearm in the commission of a crime, they're not going to care what that policy is. They don't care what that policy is. Now, I would hope that Allison's friends and family members would respect her decision. I would hope that any business owner who's coming to do work on the house there would respect her decision. But again, those aren't the people that she really has to worry about in the first place, are they? The concealed carry holders, the people who would be intent on doing Allison and her family harm. Again, if anything, they're going to be excited seeing that decal that says that this is a gun-free zone. They are not going to say, oh, well, hang on. Before we go through that door, I gotta put my gun back in the car because don't want to upset the homeowner. That's not how the world works, unfortunately. Now, she says this is a big, ugly conversation that seems worth risking. Okay, then have that big, ugly conversation as often as you want. But just know, again, that the people who would be intent on hurting you and your family, they're not going to be dissuaded. They're not going to be persuaded to leave that gun behind. Those who would want to commit an act of violence against you are only going to welcome that gun-free zone sign, unfortunately. It just seems like a weird thing to write about. But it does, again, point out the difficulty in actually enforcing gun-free zones around the country. What do you do if you want to actually ensure that your campus remains gun-free? Well, I shouldn't say remains. Remains gun-free to legal gun ownership and gun carrying. Not a lot. I mean, really what you're talking about is after the fact, perhaps an arrest can be made. But more than likely, what's going to happen is that the violent criminals aren't going to care. The students, faculty members, again, if you're talking about your business or your home, your customers, your family members, these individuals, likely to try to stay on the right side of that policy, don't want to be kicked out of school, don't want to face disciplinary charges, there at the school that you're attending or teaching at. You don't want to get kicked out of a restaurant. You don't want to face charges for violating a restaurant's policy if they're legally posted. You don't want to offend friends or family member. But again, if you're a violent criminal, you don't care about any of that. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. We've got a couple of stories for you. The first one from the Old Dominion here in Virginia, WTKR, News Channel 3 in Hampton Roads, Virginia. With the story, an 18-year-old man shot and killed Sunday by a man he was reportedly going to rob. Hampton police say 18-year-old Jafari Mitchell and a 15-year-old accomplice had approached a 71-year-old man, displayed a gun, and demanded money. The 71-year-old man, fearing for his safety, pulled out his own firearm and shot Mitchell, according to police. The 15-year-old fled from the area. The 71-year-old man remained on scene. He called 911. Police say he cooperated with the investigation. No charges are being sought against him in reference to the shooting at this time. The 15-year-old was caught nearby. He's been arrested in connection to the incident. He's been charged with one count of attempted robbery, one count of a use of firearm in the commission of a felony. News Channel 3 says he remains in custody at a secure detention facility. We'll keep our eyes on this story. But again, a 71-year-old man, probably not going to be able to protect himself from two individuals who, if you added up their age, still wouldn't be half this guy's age. But he was able to protect himself, again, because he had a firearm. Now, the other armed citizen story from the Selma Times-Journal in Selma, Alabama. A woman attempting to use an ATM there in Selma, Alabama, was the victim of an attempted robbery. Lieutenant Sam Miller of the Selma Police Department said a woman was withdrawing cash from the ATM. It was between 10:30 p.m. Monday night when she was approached by a man at gunpoint. When the woman failed to surrender her money, the Times-Journal reports, the robber began waving his gun in her face. Now, authorities say that's when the victim's grandson, who was waiting in the car for grandma, drew a firearm and exited the vehicle. The robber then opened fire at the victim's grandson. Lieutenant Miller with the Selma Police Department says the grandson returns fire as the guy was running away, shooting back at him. The robber fell to the ground and then took off running again. Miller says later that night, the Prattville Police Department called, reporting about a gunshot victim in a hospital. Lieutenant Sam Miller says the would-be robber made it home and got his mom to drive him to the hospital because he was shot in the lower back. He's currently being treated at Baptist South Hospital in Montgomery, Alabama. The police chief there in Selma, John Brock, says the robber has multiple outstanding warrants from other agencies. Lieutenant Sam Miller says we're going to have to figure out who's going to get what then, but we will file charges when he's released. In other words, you got a lot of different jurisdictions who have dibs on this guy. Pending formal charges, the Selma Times-Journal says the man's identity has not been released. So we'll keep our eyes on that story, but looks like a armed citizen coming to the aid of his grandmother there in Selma, Alabama. Now, our deal of the day, from the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Cleveland, Ohio. A home invasion suspect with a lengthy criminal history. 31-year-old Richard Legg. He is a convicted killer. He is accused now of kicking in the door of a home in the Clark Fulton neighborhood, robbing residents at gunpoint, and leading police in a high-speed chase through three counties. Yeah. He is currently in a Cuyahoga County jail cell on aggravated robbery charges. He was on both parole and probation when state highway patrol troopers spotted him and another individual. It was about 1:30 in the afternoon in a stolen car. Legg and the other man led troopers on a chase into Cuyahoga County and Lorain counties, then west into Lorain County before troopers took him into custody. Cleveland detectives say that Legg, they believe, was involved in a February 7th home invasion in the Clark Fulton neighborhood. A resident at the home was texting a drug dealer about buying four Percocet pills. According to a police report, a few hours later, Legg and an identified man kicked in the home's side door, held pistols to the heads of five people, including a 7-year-old boy. demanding money. Legg threatened to kill the child if the others didn't say where the money was. The men ransacked the home, ordered two men to take off their pants, ordered a woman to take off her sweatshirt, found $850 in cash in their pockets that the victims said was for rent. The men also stole two cell phones and a pocket knife before they left the home. Two other men waited in a green car there. Police used cell phone data from one of these stolen phones, tracked it to a street just a couple blocks away there. Sergeant found a car with a license plate number that was similar to the one given by the victim. Officer noticed a cell phone on the front seat, called the victim's phone number. The phone inside the car rang. Now, the car had been reported stolen in a carjacking earlier. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer says the aggravated robbery charge, the latest that authorities have levied against Legg, came while he was under supervision for two previous convictions. Yeah. Richard Legg was released from prison December 2nd, 2014. He served 3 years for aggravated burglary. He was paroled and placed under supervision for 3 years, but he did not show up for a parole board hearing. Looks like it might have been the first one, January 12, 2015. He was charged. He later pleaded guilty to an escape charge, and the judge in that case gave him 3 years probation. Isn't that nice? He was accused of violating the probation in November of last year. The judge then ordered him to enter into an intensive outpatient treatment. The order came days after the violent home invasion that would eventually land him back in jail. Back in 2004, Legg was convicted of manslaughter. He was 21. Plain Dealer says he catcalled Michael Vesely's wife outside of a Madison Avenue lamp store where Vesely worked. The woman told Vesely, who came out of the store and confronted Richard Legg, Legg and Vesely got into a fight. Vesely turned away. Legg threw a Mountain Dew bottle that struck him in the head. Police later found Vesely lying dead on the ground behind the store. The coroner at the time said that Vesely, who was 317 pounds, had an enlarged heart, died of a heart attack that was induced by blunt force trauma and ruled his death a homicide. Legg was indicted on murder charges as well as cocaine possession. He later pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter. He served 5 years in prison. Before that, back in 2001, Richard Legg pleaded guilty to ethnic intimidation in an attack on an Ohio City convenience store employee, called the employee a racial slur, threatened to burn the employee, and said he was going to call the area Nation because he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So 5 years for manslaughter, 3 years for aggravated burglary, 3 years of probation for escape, which he violated. And now, 31-year-old Richard Legg, who has gotten break after break after break in the criminal justice system, accused of a home invasion robbery and a high-speed chase. So what's that worth? Maybe another 3 years behind bars? I'm not sure this case has actually ended up on the front page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I don't think that this has led the nightly news, so it is very, very possible that Richard Legg is going to get yet another deal here before this story reaches its conclusion. All right, now our hero, excuse me, not our hero, our good guy of the day. Normally, you know, in this segment, we talk about the men and women in law enforcement who go above and beyond. But there was a story out of Denver, Colorado, about community members who are helping those men and women in law enforcement. The Denver Channel, Channel 7, the ABC affiliate, Sally Mamdou had the story out of Arvada, Colorado. Last month, Corporal Nate Kerrigan was shot and killed while serving an eviction notice. And Monday, they held the funeral for Nate Kerrigan. Six New York City officers, two officers from the Chicago Police Department flew to Colorado to be at the funeral procession. Jonathan Sudsky was one of them. He said, "You sympathize being a father, a brother, or a son." these officers were able to attend the funeral thanks to a nonprofit organization called Brotherhood for the Fallen. Channel 7 in Denver says the group makes it possible for officers to travel to funerals and memorial services, helping out, paying for officers to attend processions, financially helping the families of fallen officers. Officer Tim Jeffrey is the head of the Aurora, Colorado chapter of the Brotherhood of the Fallen. He said, for us to go out and support each other, not just on a local level, but on a national level as well, it has a huge impact. He said, this year alone, we have gone to 11 of the 13 officers killed in the line of duty. And so the organization is stretched a little thin. Says the Brotherhood of the Fallen rely primarily on donations from the community to help bring more officers to funerals, as well as to provide support for the families of those that have fallen. The Brotherhood for the Fallen, again, is the name of the organization. And there are lots of local organizations around the country if you want to help out those men and women who are protecting and serving the community and who want to honor those fellow law enforcement officers who have fallen in the line of duty. Now, when we come back after a quick break here on NRA News Cam and Company, Dan Bongino going to join us talking about the number of illegal immigrants, more than 100 of them released from jail, later charged with homicide. And later in the hour, Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA media liaison, will be with us as well, talking about the latest anti-gun efforts in Nevada, as well as the latest pro-gun efforts in the state of Georgia. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jose Morales, NRA training counselor. Jose, welcome to NRA News. We want to talk about the three rules of firearm safety. What are those?
Thank you very much for having me. The three NRA safety rules. The first one, the primary rule, is always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Now, what that means is we want to make sure that if that gun discharges by accident, that it's in the safest direction possible, the direction it will cause if the gun were to discharge, the least amount of property damage, the least amount of possibility of injury possible. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we never point the muzzle, which is the front of the barrel, at anything we don't want to shoot, including ourselves.
Okay. Rule number two.
Rule number two is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire, which is common sense, but as my mother says all the time, common sense is not that common. We need to make sure that our finger in my pretend gun is on the side of the gun, away from the trigger guard at all times. And our finger only enters the trigger guard when we're ready to shoot, and as soon as we're done, it's removed immediately and always kept alongside of the gun, preferably on the frame.
Okay. And what's rule number three?
Rule number three, always keep your firearms unloaded until you're ready to use them. So the moment you pick up a firearm, you have to make sure that if they have any manual safeties, they're engaged. Open up the action, remove the magazine, visually and physically inspect to make sure that there's no rounds in the chamber, and then you are ensured that the gun is empty.
Jose Morales, NRA training counselor, let's go over those three rules again. Number one.
Absolutely. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Number two is always keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And number three is always keep the gun unloaded until you're ready to use it.
All right, the three rules of firearm safety. How can we get some more information about this?
Just check on nrainstructors.org for a comprehensive list of classes, and we'd love to see people take more of them.
Jose, why is it important that we observe these three rules of gun safety?
As I tell my students and gun enthusiasts and budding gun enthusiasts, guns are incredibly safe. We are the ones that are unsafe. We are the ones that make accidents happen. And if you follow all three safety rules all the time, not when you remember, not when you feel like it, but all the time, it is literally impossible to have an accident.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people than crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire. with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem. Either we fight this cancer of corruption or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior, decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA Media Liaison, coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome from Conservative Review, Dan Bongino is with us. Dan, how you doing, sir?
Hey, doing good. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good talking with you as well. I appreciate you coming back on the program. It was fantastic seeing you up at CPAC. Hopefully you've recovered.
Yeah, we always run into each other up there, don't we? I mean, I think I saw you in an elevator there 4 years ago or 3 years ago or something, and every year we seem to catch up with each other, so that's always good.
Absolutely. So here's a not-so-good story. 124 illegal immigrants, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, released from jail, and they didn't turn their life around, Dan. They were ultimately, these 124 individuals, charged in 138 homicides.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those stories that really makes you shake your head as to, even if you were a die-hard rock-rib liberal who just supports everything from socialism to, to Fabian socialism down the line, you're in the entire spectrum there. How do you support something like this? You know, this is such an obvious ground ball. No one's saying, listen, all immigrants are... And my wife's an immigrant. She came here from Colombia. She did it the legal way along with her family. They've produced a lot for this country. American citizens, immigrants who become American citizens have done tons for this country. But to allow people into the country to commit crimes, and committing a crime, by the way, by being here, by being in the country illegally, who then are released from prison rather than deported, who then go on to kill people, it's just amazing to me that the other side just doesn't come out and take a common-sense approach and say, okay, this is a bridge too far. But they just won't do it. And let me just make one final point. This is why you're seeing the eruption in support for people like Donald Trump. The left has no one to blame but themselves. America's tired of garbage like this.
Well, I think you're right. Now, let me ask you this. What would be the common sense solution here for people who say, because I'm sure, the opposing side, Dan, would say, listen, Dan, this is a, obviously these 138 murders, these are awful, but we're talking about just a handful of people who are in this country illegally who are released from jail. You're painting with too broad a brush here.
Yeah. Well, fair enough question, but that relies on the liberal fallacy of what Thomas Sowell once called starting the story in the middle. You know, liberals love to do this. What they like to do is they like to cause problems, forget about what caused the problem, and then start the story in the middle. I'll just give you a quick example. You know, Sowell was debating this Pennsylvania social services secretary once. It was like in the 70s or something. And she brought up the fact that, Republicans, what do you want to do? You want to pull all these moms off welfare programs and their kids are going to starve? And Sowell beautifully turned the argument at her and said, you know, it's funny how you start the story in the middle, but you never address ever how all of these women got on welfare in the first place because of the policies you support in these neighborhoods. The same exact thing applies to immigration. if we would actually support a simple solution like a controllable border with appropriate fencing and insecurity, which is not difficult to do. We sent a man to the moon. We can do this. A lot of these problems wouldn't happen. And also, not to mention, we don't have to release people once they are caught for violating our immigration laws. There's nothing compassionate about releasing potential felons back into the population to commit crimes in the American people. You break our laws, you should be deported. It's as simple as that, and you can come back the right way like my people like my wife chose to do. None of this is complicated. But it's for leftists, though. They have a hard time with that.
Talking again with Dan Bongino of Conservative Review. And by the way, this is one crime. The most heinous crime I think that there is when you're talking about taking a human life, an innocent human life. But, there are a lot of other crimes out there, Dan. And so, these individuals, again, who are in this country illegally, they've been released from jail, perhaps because of a court orders. In some cases, apparently, other countries wouldn't take these individuals back. And so, I said, well, okay, then I guess you're here now. These individuals are responsible for a fairly significant amount of violent crime.
You know, yeah, it's incredible when I get into these debates with leftists. And, you know, I say leftists, I don't mean Democrats. There's a lot of good Democrats out there fed up with this nonsense, too. It's just incredible how they love to support laws that agree with them ideologically. They're all law and order when it comes to Obamacare. You know, Obamacare stinks, but I'll tell you what. You know, it stinks, but it's the law. I'm not a lawbreaker. I know we have to do our damage in the election booth, so I obey the law with Obamacare. I wish I didn't have to. I'm paying a fortune for my family unnecessarily. So the left will tell you it's the law of the land. But so is immigration. It's clear as day. Like, any buffoon can read the immigration law. But then the left goes, oh, no. It's not the law of the land when it's going to hurt our electoral chances in the future. And just to show you how hypocritical they are about this entire thing, do you know how many times Republicans have put in poison pills, Cruz being one of them, where they put in a poison pill saying, you know what, you really care about these immigrants? I'll tell you what, we'll support everything you have here except for the fact that the people you're going to make citizens and give amnesty to, they can't have citizenship. They can only have legal residency, meaning they can't vote. Do you know the left says no every time? That should tell you one simple thing. The left doesn't care about these people. They don't care about immigrants. They don't care about the law. They care about votes, folks. It's as simple as that. You're being suckered if you believe otherwise, because Republicans have actually offered residency. And they said, no, we want citizenship or else they can't come in at all, because they want the votes. It's it. It's as simple as that. Don't be a fool for these people.
Dan Bongino's book, The Fight, A Secret Service Agent's Inside Account of Security Failings in the Political Machine. Kind of sounds like what you were just describing there, Dan, right? I mean, because we know that when it comes to, again, to issues of border security, we are talking about security. And we've also seen those security failings, and in large part because of the political machine. I mean, this is a prime example, I think, of what you're talking about in your book.
Yeah, I have an entire chapter in my book about how the incentive in government. People have think sometimes on the right that the incentive is always to do something in government, that something is bad vis-a-vis Obamacare. And, of course, that stuff like that happens. But a lot of times with the failures of government are because they were incentivized to not do things. In other words, like I used the White House fence for an example. Like, the incentive for government officials was to not change it because you didn't want to put your signature on the change, because, God forbid, someone jumped the new White House fence, you'd be responsible. And you see that with social programs as well in government. And that's what I talk about with security failings in the political machine. Everything from our security failures, our foreign policy failures, to our social program failures, our bankruptcy, impending national bankruptcy. A lot of it's due to government bureaucrats not wanting to do something because they don't want to risk their own jobs. And I go into kind of the inside baseball about how that happens.
And, you know, and to that end, we've seen stories today, as a matter of fact, in Brussels, a anti-terror sweep. You've got three officers who are injured. The authorities are saying that this was related to the attack on Paris. We know, Dan, there are people out there who want to murder all of us, no matter where we stand on the political spectrum, no matter who we're supporting for president, or if we've decided to heck with it, I'm not voting this year. There are individuals and forces out there who want to see all of us dead. How concerned are you about the current state of our government and the willingness of this administration to take these threats seriously?
Yeah, very. My first book, and I kind of go into it in my second book a little bit as well, how the terrorists figured out a long time ago that they didn't need to spend, you know, up to $1 million, depending on where, you know, what information you look at, which is what they spent on 9/11 and years in flight training, that they only had to get, you know, acquire illegally, of course, which is what they always do, Kalashnikov, you know, with a couple 7.62 rounds and start spraying in a mall, and they were going to cause the same amount of terror. They figured this out a long time ago. What really worries me is the Obama administration's hesitancy to call it what it is and what the motivation is. Of course it doesn't involve all Muslims. The fact that we have to say that is embarrassing. We only have to say it because the left puts us in a corner because they like to play division politics. But we do have to call radical Islamic terror what it is. And I've called for this over and over and over again, along with a number of other security professionals. You know, thank God for states like Florida, where I live, where any person can, who really without a criminal record, can acquire the ability to protect themselves. Because the last thing you want to be doing, as most of your listeners know, is staring down the business end of a 7.62 round and asking for mercy. You want to be sending bullets downrange the other way to get you and your kids out of there. So thank God for Texas and Florida and other states that allow their citizens to defend themselves.
You're down there in Florida, Dan. How's the turnout been where you are today?
Oh, it's insane. You know, we say Florida, yeah, Florida, we shoot back, right? But, down here in the election, the turnout's been just, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I think they had something like 1.1 million votes cast already. It's just an early voting and absentee. I mean, I've lived in Maryland and New York. In Maryland, in the entire gubernatorial election, in the general election for the governorship, only about, 900,000 votes were cast. So that should put in context what turnout. That this is even before Election Day in Florida. So, it's pretty incredible. And I can tell you from firsthand experience as an activist first, I give about 2-3 speeches a week. People are really, really fed up. I mean, like, their fun meters are absolutely pegged right now. And, you know, they're ready for some serious change. And let's hope this election brings it.
All right, Dan. Listen, I appreciate you coming to the program, sir. It's always a pleasure. And I hope we can do this again very soon.
Anytime, brother. You got it.
All right. Dan Bongino writing that Conservative Review again. You can pick up his book, The Fight, A Secret Service Agent's Inside Account of Security Failings and the Political Machine. Catherine Mortensen, NRA-ILA Media Liaison, going to join us here in just a couple of minutes, talking about what is going on in Nevada, where Bloomberg's anti-gun groups teaming up with churches in the state to push their background check referendum. Also in Georgia, we'll talk with Catherine about the campus carry bill that is on the desk of Governor Nathan Deal. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
With Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways. Totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them. And everything is different, and it's funny, I have a video out that akin's the firearm to buying your bra. if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
But, and I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like, guys are like, honey, try this big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You've got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Yeah. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's
here.
Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but you went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kellyanne, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Want to welcome to the program right now NRA ILA Media Liaison Catherine Mortensen is with us. Catherine, how are you doing this afternoon?
Great. Thank you so much, Cam.
Absolutely. Always glad to have you. And the Las Vegas Review-Journal had an interesting story here. Nevadans for Background Checks teaming up with a local church to hold a, quote, educational seminar on the issue there on Monday night. Now, I'm wondering, Catherine, is this education or is this more indoctrination and propaganda here that's being taught?
Yes, it's indoctrination and propaganda. And Cam, you know, it's just unfortunate that Bloomberg-backed groups are using these houses of worship and attempting to mislead good people about a bad initiative that could criminalize the everyday acts of the state's law-abiding gun owners. And I don't blame the church, because from the article, it sounds like the Bloomberg groups contacted them. So they are trying to co-opt good people who mean well and are just trying to get to the truth, but bringing Bloomberg into their house of worship and the lies that he is peddling about this initiative, I don't think it's going to enlighten them much.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the Review Journal itself says congregants asked questions about, now this was, again, supposed to be an educational meeting here. There were representatives from the Bloomberg group there, along with the pastor of the church. Congregants asked questions about whether the proposed law would stop straw purchases or whether inherited guns would be have to take into a dealer to sell off. The Reverend Ann Thomas did her best to answer the congregants using her smartphone to look up the ballot measure language on the Nevada Secretary of State's website. So I'm wondering, I mean, what is the point here if the people putting on this seminar couldn't really explain or couldn't answer the concerns of the congregants? Again, this it doesn't sound very educational to me.
No, and I'm not surprised that she was struggling and having to look it up on her smartphone, because we've had teams of attorneys here at the NRA and our research department spend weeks going over the language. It is very confusing. It's not easy to understand because it's just not transparent language. And we've done, I mean, we're doing the best we can to understand it. And from what our attorneys tell us, it's a train wreck. It will be a disaster for law-abiding gun owners in Nevada. But for the regular citizen to try to look it up on their own, it's not easy to understand. And I think, Cam, as you've seen over the years with these gun control laws and these bills, they intentionally make it difficult for the everyday person to understand what's in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's by design. So, you know, I feel bad for these poor churchgoers out there in Nevada, because I don't think they were getting the truth. I don't think they were getting all the answers.
Well, I think that you're right. I mean, the Review Journal itself says, quote, the initiative makes exceptions for the transfer, for temporary transfers only in established shooting ranges, at competitions or performances within a family, and in legal hunting areas with permits. So one of the things that, folks are concerned about, you know, if you just go out to do some plinking, you're not hunting, you're not, you know, at a range. Maybe you're just out on private property or out in the desert on BLM land or a land where it's legal for you to shoot, but you're not hunting, you're not engaged in a shooting competition. Are you going to violate the law by letting your friend shoot your firearm?
Well, our attorneys say yes. That is how we look at it. There are all sorts of things that law-abiding gun owners in Nevada do every day with friends, coworkers, and that could put them in jeopardy. One of the things that's a real problem, especially in Nevada, because we have so many members of the military who serve there, is when they get deployed overseas, right now, you can ask a friend to store your firearms because you can't take your personal firearms with you. And that's not a big deal. I mean, people do it all the time. But under the terms of this initiative, you'd have to submit to background checks. There would be a cost involved. There would be a legal transfer so that your friend now, in the eyes of the law, would own your firearms. And what do you do if he is not your friend when you get back and all of a sudden he owns your firearms? These are just questions that our attorneys say would put people in jeopardy. And we don't want the law-abiding people of Nevada to have to be subjected to criminal penalties, and they are some serious criminal penalties too, by the way. A lot of people think that these might be just sort of minor infractions. Here's an example. Any transferor who does not comply with these requirements could be charged with a gross misdemeanor, and upon conviction would face up to 364 days in jail and a fine of up to $2,000 on a first offense. A second and subsequent offense would be punished as a Category C felony, which carries a potential punishment up to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. So we're not talking small potatoes here.
No, we're not. But we're also talking about, again, laws that are aimed at legal gun owners. I mean, that's the crazy thing about this, Catherine, is that we're talking about, you know, looking here at the exemption. I'm looking at the Secretary of State's website, and you're right. This is 8 pages long. The language for this ballot initiative, there are a few and only a few exceptions. They say a temporary transfer of a firearm to a person who is not prohibited from buying or possessing firearms under state or federal law, if such transfer, for instance, is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm and lasts only as long as immediately necessary to prevent such imminent death or great bodily harm. What does that even mean at that point? Like if someone comes to you and says, hey, you know, I'm really concerned for my safety, you know that they're they're not a prohibited person. You know that they could legally own that firearm. Is it okay to loan them a firearm? They're concerned about their personal safety. There may be a specific individual who is threatening them, but are they under threat of imminent death or great bodily harm? You shouldn't have to be an attorney to help out a friend or a family member in need.
You're exactly right, Cam. As our attorneys read that and explained it to me, they said this language would mean that if you have a friend who wants to borrow a firearm because she may be concerned for her safety, she may have a stalker or an ex-boyfriend or someone, you cannot loan her your firearm until literally the moment that the attacker is standing over her. And then you could be like a foot away and hand her your gun and she could defend herself. But you couldn't give it to her, you know, a week in advance. It doesn't make common sense. It's not how people act in real life. It's not what people do to protect themselves.
Yeah. And they say, again, as far as, you know, transfers for if you want to go shooting with friends, such transfers would have to take place exclusively, they say, at an established shooting range authorized by the governing body of a jurisdiction in which such range is located, at a lawful organized competition involving the use of a firearm, while participating in or practicing for a performance by an organized group that uses firearms as part of the public performance, while hunting or trapping, if the hunting or trapping is legal in all places where the transferee possesses the firearm, or while in the presence of the transferer. So if you've got a friend who wants to go out shooting, maybe they're going to go to their family ranch in Nevada, they want to borrow your firearm, that apparently, from what I'm reading this, and I'm not an attorney, but that would not be allowed.
I don't think it would be. And what's very common in Nevada and a lot of our western states is there's a lot of BLM land, mm-hmm. and people go plinking out on the BLM land. I know I did when I was in Colorado, and oh, you'd be breaking all sorts of laws under this language if you were to share a firearm with someone out on that BLM land, because that's not a certified firing, range. I mean, it's just a mess. And I think the people of Nevada are slowly going to, you know, they're getting the message that this is not a bill that's in their best interest. And it's certainly not going to make them any safer, and it's not going to protect them from criminals getting access to firearms. That's the big myth, that these universal background checks will suddenly bring criminals into compliance with the law, and they'll stand in line and fill out the paperwork and pay their fee. No, that's not how criminals work.
Yeah, no, unfortunately not. And, you know, when criminals are likely to be in a position where they can be charged with a violation of this proposed statute, frankly, Catherine, they're likely to be facing much more serious charges that, you know, would hopefully uh-huh. lead to more prison time. I mean, this to me seems like one of those charges. If you're going to use it against a violent criminal, it's likely to be dropped in a plea bargain. But if you're going to use this, if this is the only charge that you have against an otherwise legal law-abiding gun owner, then that's the charge that gets prosecuted.
That's right. I think you're right, Cam.
All right. So what should gun owners?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what should gun owners in Nevada be doing right now?
Well, I think they need to be educating themselves and getting the message to their friends and neighbors, writing letters to the editor. And if they see of anything like this in their churches where the Bloomberg groups are coming in, maybe they could contact the NRA. We may be able to bring our own representatives, or they could show up and citizens can figure this out and speak the truth. I think we just need to get out there and be vocal. Because if we're not, you know, the Bloomberg groups are going to take over the message. And all too often, they make their mistruths and lies sound reasonable.
Talking again with Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILE, media liaison, about what's going on in Nevada, where this ballot initiative will be before voters in the fall. Meanwhile, Catherine, I've got to ask you about something that's before Virginia Governor Nathan Deal. Well, we've got you here. The campus safety bill, campus carry on his desk. Governor Deal has indicated that they'd like to see some changes. We only have a couple of days left of the session. What should gun owners be doing right now?
Well, you're right. Down in Georgia, Governor Deal has these newfound concerns about this critical campus safety bill. And frankly, here at the NRA, we are baffled because it was only about 2 weeks ago where he told a local newspaper in Atlanta that critics and the opposition to this campus carry bill, that their concerns were not valid. He said they lacked validity. So we felt very good that he would be on board and support this important legislation. So we're not sure where his concerns are coming from. I know that we want to address them and work with him, but we're also asking our members to contact the governor directly, either through email or a phone call, and respectfully express their support for this bill. I'll give you the bill number. It is
859, right?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yep, 859, House Bill 859 in Georgia. We're asking our members to contact Governor Deal and tell them that this is important for people's safety on public universities and public campuses there in Georgia. And we don't understand where the governor's concerns are coming from. We felt that he was on board with this bill. He has been very supportive of Second Amendment legislation in the past. So we just want our members to respectfully, you know, call on him to sign this important bill. And as you said, there's only a few days left in the legislature there in Georgia. And we know from past experience states that have campus carry laws, campus safety laws, these laws actually make the students safer. And I can give you one very good example. Since becoming legal in Utah, at the University of Utah, that's been about a decade ago, the campus experienced a drop in the rates of violent crime, forcible rapes, and aggravated assaults. So across the board, we saw crime go down at the University of Utah when those students were allowed to open carry, or concealed carry, rather.
Wow. And I haven't seen any concerns about speech being chilled on college campuses or irresponsible drunken college students causing mayhem there at the University of Utah. That hasn't happened. What has happened, as you say, is there have been fewer crimes there on campus. Catherine, unfortunately, we've got to run, but thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you, Cam. We appreciate it.
Always
thank
a pleasure
you.
Talking with you. Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA Media Liaison, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We only have about 60 seconds left here on this edition of the program, but I do want to give you a sneak peek at what is coming up on tomorrow's NRA News, Cam and Company. We'll be talking about the Super Tuesday 2 results. Will there be more clarity? Will there be more confusion as we continue on during the presidential primary process? We'll also talk, I'm very excited about this, with the West Virginia University freshman Jenny Thrasher, who is your NCAA small bore champion. Mm-hmm. Part of the West Virginia Mountaineers team that won its fourth consecutive NCAA rifle championship over the weekend. Really looking forward to talking with Jenny Thrasher from the D.C. area, as a matter of fact. Coming up on tomorrow's NRA News, Cam and Company, plus more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. Have a fantastic rest of your Tuesday. We'll see you here soon with another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.